So he's wanting to sort out that whole issue of the green fuels change. We have a group of commissioners.
Call to order the, what are we called?
This would be.
Well, I want to get it right because I think that this might have been a subject of discussion. The Senate Special Committee on Sustainable Transportation.
That's it, yes.
So we have quite an agenda today. We only have one bill amendment to speak about, but there are a lot of people that want to speak. I don't anticipate that everybody that would like to speak is going to have time to speak, and it is most important because of the late time in session that we are able to flush out what the amendment, proposed amendment, actually does. I think it's no secret, but in case anybody is not aware, there has been a bipartisan, bicameral group of legislators that has been meeting on how they might advance the transportation package this legislative session. I believe Senators Johnson and Cruz and Whitsitt were all a part of those discussions.
That's correct.
And they are here on the committee. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm with Senator Beyer.
Yep, so. And Senator Beyer was the other senator on that committee. And so there have been a lot of discussions over the last couple of weeks about the proposed package may or may not contain. I have heard at least three or four different versions myself. We haven't had something in a written amendment form to actually study until yesterday evening. So we are now diving into the public process to shine a light on what is in the proposed amendment. And obviously there are, you know, you could go this way with the amendment, you could go that way with the amendment, either of which raises concerns from different groups. And so we're going to dive into that and hopefully shed some light on this and get the public input and scrutiny and then see where we go from there. So, we're scheduled to be here from 1 to 3. I doubt that we'll get through everybody that wants to testify by then. I will stay as long as I can to continue taking more testimony, but it is most important to me that we actually get right to the root of what different folks claim that the package will or will not do, and we have chance for cross-examination, if you will, by committee members. So I've asked proponents and opponents to put together some panels. And so what we're going to do is we're going to start with legislative counsel is here. They'll explain what the amendment does and to House Bill 2281B. Then we'll have a panel that is in favor of the amendment and explain it from their perspective. Then we'll have a couple of panels address different concerns that they have. And then we'll have a panel of folks that is in favor of the transportation aspect of this. So first it's going to be about the carbon reduction aspects. Then we're going to do the transportation aspects. And then if we still have time, and I hope that we do, but can't promise anything, we'll start just working our way through panels of people that have signed up and people that have signed up to testify. And hopefully we'll be able to work in people by the end of the meeting that have come from a long way away and have traveled from a long way away. I hope that we can do that. But again, I can't promise anything. So before we do that, we're going to need to adopt some rules. And Patrick?
I'll thank you, Mr. Chair. The rules have been posted on OLIS. We received them from the Secretary of Senate this morning. About 10:30, 11 o'clock, they are similar to rules for other committees that have been structured in this way, Senate Special Committee rules. They're available. I can answer any questions if you have any questions, but they're very similar to the rules that the other Senate committees have operated under all session, Mr. Chair.
Want me to move it?
Please.
I move that we adopt the committee rules.
Senator Gerard has moved that we adopt the committee rules as posted on OLS and described by Patrick. Is there any discussion about the motion? Are there any objections to the motion? Okay, the motion carries. So we are now official. And then do we need anything else before we open up a work set or a public hearing?
That'd be all we need, Mr. Chair.
Yep. I can feel hearts panic all when I said work session.
So, let's go.
Committee members included.
So we are going to open up a work session on, excuse me, God. We are going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2281. And so, Legislative Council, if you could come forward and tell us what we're looking at in this, in the, I believe it's the B7 amendment, and then the panel that should be ready after them is Paul Romaine and Brian Doherty.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Elliott. I'm here from the Office of Legislative Council. And
my name is Maureen McGee, and I'm also here from the Office of Legislative Council.
I will be going through the first portion of the bill, which is the transportation portion, and I'll just be walking you through sections and groups as they relate to each other. So sections 1 through 4 increase the gas tax from 30 cents to 32 cents beginning January 1 of 2016. Sections 5 through 8 increase the gas tax another 2 cents to 34 cents beginning January 1, 2017. Section 10 creates a new vehicle title fee of $125. Section 11 increases the vehicle registration fees by $10 for passenger vehicles and low-speed vehicles, $6 for motorcycles and mopeds, and $145 for electric and hybrid vehicles. We also have a corresponding increases for heavy vehicles, which is required by the Oregon Constitution. Those are in sections 12 through 14 of the bill. And all of those monies are distributed in section 17 of the bill. And they're distributed as we typically distribute monies.
Put in page numbers as you go along.
Oh, sorry, I don't have page numbers. So section 17, my page numbers might not be the same as yours. On my page, it's 23. So of the increases, 50% will go to the Department of Transportation, 30% will go to counties, and 20% will go to the cities. Of the 50% going to the Department of Transportation, 49% shall be used for bridges, 32% to pay for debt service, and 19% for state highway maintenance and preservation. Section 18 is really the heart of the bill as far as the transportation package is concerned. Section 18 concerns all of the allocated amounts for each of the Department of Transportation's 5 regions, as well as a comprehensive list of all the transportation projects that will be funded with the increased revenues. Going on to Section 19. Oh, excuse me. Section 18A requires that ODOT conduct a study and prepare a plan for improving hazardous routes along the hazardous route along Cornelius Pass Road, and present that study to and plan to the Legislative Assembly. Then in Section 19, ODOT is directed to work within their Oregon Innovative Partnership Program, otherwise known as P3, private public partnerships, to look into widening a portion of I-5 from the Stafford Road to Oregon, I-205 from Stafford Road to Oregon City. In Section 20 through 21, we take a portion, if you remember I mentioned that 32% of the revenues raised is going to be used for debt service for the bonds, but those bonds are actually dealt with in Sections 20 to 22. That's the $400 million of highway user bonds that are going to be used to pay for those projects that are listed in Section 18 of the bill.
Okay.
Moving on to Section 24. I'm trying to find a page number for you. It starts on page 29. The temporary driver license fee increase. Between 2016 and 2017, Class C driver license issuance, renewal, and replacements of driver permits will go up by $10, and the money is to be used to improve and modernize Department of Transportation's DMV's IT system.
Mr. Chair, if I could, just to point out on that, the reason for doing that is not to get into the road fund for the IT project.
Then in sections 31 through 35, there's currently in statute for mass transit districts authorization to impose an employer payroll tax. The changes to the in these sections will direct transit agency who has taken advantage of the employer payroll tax to also impose an employee payroll tax of 0.185% on employees that are within those districts. And then Section 36 provides a general fund appropriation to the Oregon State University for engineering research and development into clean diesel and engine technology. Section 37 directs the Director of Transportation to procure an independent efficiency management review and to prepare and implement a plan to redirect $50 million each year for highway maintenance and preservations, and to present that plan each year to the Legislative Assembly between January of 2017 to January of 2024. And then finally, Section 38A directs the department to provide a quarterly report of the revenues raised in this bill to the Legislative Revenue Office. And then that brings us to Maureen's portion of the bill.
Yes, so again, my name is Maureen McGee, and I'll be walking us through the carbon reduction aspects of the bill. So starting in Section 39, we have the Low Carbon Blending Program. Section 39 repeals the Clean Fuels Program as it was amended by Senate Bill 324 earlier this session. And sections 40 through 47 of the bill replace that with a low carbon blending program that will be administered by the Department of Agriculture and that builds upon the renewable fuel standard requirements that are already overseen by the Department of Ag. Looking at that in more detail, the heart of the low carbon blending program is located in Section 42 of the bill. Section 42 requires the Department of Ag to adopt by rule the low carbon blending program with the goal to reduce over time and subject to availability the price and feasibility, the carbon intensity of gasoline and diesel fuel sold or offered in this state. The section lays out a low-carbon blending benchmark schedule in statute that the department would be required to follow in incrementally increasing the amounts of carbon intensity reductions that will be required over time. Process for doing that is that the department will conduct an annual study of the commercial availability of low-carbon intensity fuels in the state. That study will take into account the cost of the fuel, the technological feasibility of the fuel being used, and other aspects related to commercial availability, such as the ability of facilities to produce marketable amounts of the fuel. Based on that study, the department will determine whether or not it can move up to the next incremental benchmark in the percentage of carbon intensity reductions that will be required in fuel sold or offered in this state during the next following calendar year. And again, that is an annual process that will occur. If the department determines under the study that there will not be enough fuel, low carbon intensity fuel commercially available to move up to the next benchmark, producer or dealers within the state will be required to meet whatever the current benchmark level is. And that is all contained in Section 42 of the bill. Again, Section 43 provides that that program will first apply to dealers on January 1st of 2018, and Section 44 requires the Department of Agriculture to submit an annual report to the Legislative Assembly on the implementation of the blending program. The Sections 45 and 46 of the bill are amendments to the renewable fuel standard statutes that will allow for blends that are at higher, blends of fuels at levels higher than E10 for gasoline and higher than B5 for biodiesel to be sold within the state, subject to technological feasibility and labeling standards. And then in sections 48 through 55 of the bill, we get to the electric vehicle and natural gas vehicle market transformation program. This program has a couple of aspects. First, there is an amendment in section 48 of the bill to the public purpose charge. That amendment repeals the provisions requiring 10%, the first 10% of the funds collected under the public purpose charge to go to schools, and also redistributes the other monies provided under the public purpose charge such that 17% will go to market incentives for the purchase and installation of electric vehicle charging infrastructure. In section 52 of the bill is a requirement for the development of a framework for this program. The framework will be developed by the Public Utility Commission in consultation with the Department of Energy. They'll also work with investor-owned utilities, the propane industry, to and investor-owned utilities, by the way, includes both electric and natural gas utilities. So the commission and the Department of Energy will work with these organizations to develop a vehicle market transformation framework that can be used by the utilities, the propane industry, the Citizens Utility Board, and the ETO to create market incentives for the installation of electric vehicle infrastructure as well as the purchase of compressed natural gas or propane-fueled vehicles and school buses and the installation of compressed natural gas propane vehicle fueling infrastructure that's readily available for local school district fueling. And they will need to work with an advisory committee in developing that framework. Then finally, in section 55 of the bill, there is a provision to allow public utilities to include in their rates the costs of installing electric vehicle infrastructure and the costs of installing compressed natural gas vehicle infrastructure subject to certain requirements. And that's it for my portions.
All right. Well, before we move on to the panels of testimony, do any of the members of the committee have questions about of legislative council about different sections of the bill, how it's laid out? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right, so next up, Paul Romaine and Brian Doherty, and then after that, we'll have Jana Gastelum, Gavin Carpenter, and Meredith Shield. Yeah.
Gage before me.
Brian just told me I'm older. I get to go first. So I'm sitting far away from Brian. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland with the Romaine Group. We represent the Oregon Fuels Association, and we are the small guys. He's big guy, we're small guy. So we're the dealers and jobbers in the state. Our issue with the is really with the low carbon fuel standard, and we have not been shy over the last few months in expressing that to most of you, if not every one of you, sometimes over and over again. The problem with the low carbon fuel standard is it really is not a low carbon fuel standard. It's a way, it's the classic where you make something impossible and then give somebody an opportunity to buy their way out. That was the portion that we'd objected to. What we see in this bill, at least, is realistic blending. And we've always said we will blend that which is available and that costs equivalent to gasoline or diesel. But to basically punish us when, through no fault of our own, the fuel isn't available is not really appropriate. So that's the portion that we have always objected to. We think that this program, with the infrastructure created, with everything that goes with it, is actually a way to get good carbon reduction in the state, real carbon reduction, and it's not, in effect, a hidden tax. And so that's why we are looking optimistically at the portion of the bill that deals with fuel blending as a way to move forward.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Brian Doherty with the Miller Nash Graham and Dunn Law Firm, testifying on behalf of Western States Petroleum Association. First of all, I'd like to extend my sincere thanks to Legislative Counsel Maureen McGee, who did just a terrific job of trying to put all this together. I'm here testifying today on Sections 39 to 47, the low carbon fuel standard. We have worked extensively for the past 6 years with the Department of Environmental Quality in expressing our concerns with the type of program that eventually became Senate Bill 324. It is simply a mandated program that was infeasible and would require us to essentially buy out our system. After 324 was passed, we had a number of legislators contact us and ask if we could do something that would control the consumer costs in that 324 bill. We put together a framework, and the, as I call them, the G8, the group 8 had done a lot of work on this with legislative counsel to come up with a bill. I think it has the appropriate mix of a low carbon fuel standard that requires a reduction through time in the carbon intensity, which we've been doing, and we have been doing through the federal RFS and the state RFS. We're not objecting to lowering carbon and fuel. It's the manner in which you do it. This is a market-based mechanism that has consumer cost containment measures in it, and that's what you will see in it. And I'll be happy to answer any questions, but I as I said, I'm supportive of that, and I really appreciate what the senators and House members also did to try and come up with this proposal. Thank you.
Okay. I have a couple questions, but anybody else want to start? Okay. So I'd like to specifically ask you your thoughts about the what I refer to as the on-ramp. So low carbon, or so the Senate Bill 324, you guys like to call it low carbon fuel standards. I like to call it clean fuels, but we won't argue about that. That bill had the mechanism in place with the department to develop off ramps or rip cords, if you will, if the prices were going to get out of control. This bill says, well, we can't. If I'm understanding it correctly, and please tell me if I'm not, and that's what a lot of this hearing is about. Because we haven't had a lot of time to look at it. My understanding is that this requires the study by the Department of Ag about the commercial feasibility and availability of biofuels, and then if it is determined that they are commercially available at a price, then the next increment of requirement would go into effect. And so to me, that feels more like an on-ramp into the program with a certain threshold that needs to be met. And what I've been concerned about, and please tell me if you have a different perspective, what I've been concerned about is that it sets up this chicken and egg scenario where They can't go out and they can't build the capacity or, and I'm not sure how much of it, and I'm going to ask the next panel how much of it's related to capacity versus actual feedstock, feedstock versus the actual production capacity. But until that can be demonstrated, which may require investment, which requires some investor certainty, then the new blending requirements would never kick in, and we'll never get there. And that's been a concern of mine as I've been hearing what this proposal may or may not do. But so hopefully we can start digging into these issues today.
I'll go ahead. Chair Edwards, you're correct that this is an on-ramp rather than an off-ramp. It has built into it is all in the cost containment issues about whether it is available, whether it is cost effective, and whether it's feasible with respect to the new low carbon fuels, with respect to the infrastructure to deliver the fuels, and with respect to the vehicles that are going to be combusting the fuels. And that is the way to ensure that you have something that's realistic and in the market, not simply something that may be there but not in sufficient quantities to supply Oregon's market. To allay one of your concerns, or at least to discuss this, you mentioned about how do we go forward? How does it happen? Well, the good thing about this is that California is going forward ahead of us. They are 10 times our market size. Oregon, Washington, California, Oregon is 7% of the fuel consumption of the three states. California is 21%, Washington is 21%, California is 70%. California this fall is going to start back up its program of lowering its carbon. That is a market in which fuel suppliers, I think, will be working hard to lower their carbon to meet. And that will be the bow wave that we can come behind in the wake of it. It was with our numbers coming up behind them. They're doing an aggressive program trying to get up to 10% reduction by 2020. So we think that that's going to offer some assurance that there is going to be a market there. For example, right now we have the market. The ethanols and biodiesels can meet the standard and can meet the standard when it drops, I think, by 0.25 and 0.5. And they're even lowering further. California will come out here this fall with new carbon numbers for the biofuels, and I believe they're going to be lower. They have some information on indirect land use, other things like that, and then I think they're going to issue rules for adoption and continuing their program ratchet down. That's what I would suggest. Thank you.
If I might chime in a little bit. Yes, this is an on-ramp, but there is certainty out there. If you develop the fuel that has a lower carbon content, if you lower the carbon content of your ethanol, then and it's available, then the program says we'll blend it, basically. So you are creating the market. What you're not doing is saying to people ahead of time, we guarantee you that you're going to have all this money ahead of time. What you're saying is you have to take the risk, set up the fuel, develop the fuel. If it's there, we're going to have to buy it. But the fuel has to be there before we have to buy it. The way the low-carbon fuel standard was set up, and by the way, in the back rooms, it's been called many other things besides low-carbon fuel standard, usually with an adjective ahead of it. But you have the incentive that if you build it, we will come. It's field of dreams. You build it, we're going to be there. If you don't build it, we don't have to pay you. But if you build it, we're there.
Yeah, and that's been one of my questions since I first started hearing about this proposal floating around, and I hadn't seen any details is whether or not there were specifics about details about what constitutes availability. And I mean, does that mean it has to be all produced and sitting in a tank, or does it mean that the production capacity just has to be there, or does that mean that there has to be demonstrated, certain supply of feedstock? And so that's, these are some questions and some concerns that I've had over this, but I'm, just trying to work through that. So. Other questions? The other, I guess I did have another question, and that was, so if I mean, so Brian, you said that California is going to drive the market availability of this, and but if they have an aggressive program, aren't they going to just consume it? I mean, it seems like they would be driving the market availability of biofuels in California, but not necessarily in Oregon. And so, and I mean, I'm just, again, I don't know enough about what it takes to build a biofuels plant and how much of that capacity would be unused, and where the real hurdles are. Are the hurdles in the feedstocks or the hurdles in actually just investor certainty in building the plant?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sorry I didn't do that ahead of time for the other one.
But,
you illustrate a problem that we in the in-state market, the jobbers and dealers have. If California basically eats up everything so there's nothing available here, then we can't really comply with a program that mandates that we be there ahead of the availability of the fuel. You have to have the fuel available for us to be able to meet the standard. Otherwise, we either have to really bid up the cost of the stuff to kind of get it, or we have to stop selling. So that's the problem. It's the money portion of it that becomes the problem. It's not the fuel's going to be available. People will, if you say to them there's a market available for you if you build it, then they're going to build it.
Mm-hmm. Might I just fill in too? Currently, Oregon's blending 170 million gallons of ethanol a year. Just double that by 10, and that's 1.7 billion roughly. The California, that, to quote my number, but it's roughly in these ballparks. And we have enough fuel to do that, biofuels to do that. That's what you need to meet in this program. So it's happening now. It can happen further. California will start saying it's going to be 2% before we are, and then we're thinking that's going to drive people to get more lower carbon fuels. You're right. Availability has to be availability. If it's not there, it's not there. Today, they've been able to outfit a lot of states are doing biofuels, including California, with a large consumption appetite. And what I want to also say, what's available means available in the state, not produced in the state. It can be produced in the state, but we're saying it can be produced anywhere in the world, so as, and it can come in here. So we're not limiting okay. the availability of the biofuels that are produced.
Is there, you made a reference, actually I can't remember if it was your legislative council made a reference to the, in speaking of the availability, the cost effectiveness, and then you mentioned something with respect to vehicles, or could you expand on that?
Chair Edwards, yes, it's feasibility of the system, the overall system, to hold those fuels. For example, going to much higher alcohol contents has an issue with infrastructure at the retail stations, pumps, hoses, all the delivery system. It has issues with certain models and makes of cars that can't handle higher alcohol ethanol systems. And you have the fuel itself. Let's say we invent a new lower carbon biofuel and we find out it has properties that can't go through the system. So we need to be sure it's feasible inside the system of delivery, all the way from the fuel to the vehicle.
Okay. And then, so what are what does current law allow a distributor or blender to blend? How much, say biodiesel? How high can they blend currently without having to change how they're labeling it?
Current,
I've been told it's pretty high.
Diesel is different than ethanol. I mean, the diesel is different than gasoline. We have B99 available. There's B20. There's all types of B that's available. The standard blend is B5. It's the gasoline that causes more issues as far as getting it out there.
Okay.
Current law, excuse me, Chair Edwards, current law says at least B5 in Oregon.
Yeah.
And the federal law is similar, a B5 standard. So all your fuel has at least B5 in it.
Okay. And I asked
all your
that.
Diesel fuel, excuse me.
Okay, yeah, at least B5. And I asked that because I've been told that they can diesel. And I appreciate the distinction between ethanol and diesel. I've been told that they can blend up to B19. It's just hearsay to me. I haven't actually seen it. But people have told me that you can blend up to B19 without even changing the label on the pump. And, in fact, distributors do that. And it's a price decision. If the biodiesel is cheaper than the petroleum diesel, then they do that currently. And, in fact, a number of stations have been.
Mr. Chair, without giving away any secrets of any members of this illustrative body, there are some who take full advantage of the fact that B20 does not have a tax on it.
Okay. Senator Steiner-Hayward, you had a question?
I was just trying to clarify. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify. If I understood you, Mr. Doherty, you were saying that there are issues with the infrastructure on the gasoline side. And I thought Chair Edwards was asking a question about how high can the current equipment tolerate in terms of the E side of this. Right now, E10's working, and we're okay with that. But current vehicles, current infrastructure, is there an issue with blending at a higher rate? And if so, what's our maximum with the current infrastructure?
Chair Edwards, Senator Steiner-Hayward, there is EA5 available. You need to have a vehicle that's called a flex fuel vehicle.
Right.
We have right now, the law says E10. And the EPA has been tried to look at voluntary E15 and looked at trying some higher blends. There are issues, and there's studies about the issues with makes and model years, not all makes, not all model years, up through, I believe, 2012, that have problems and have been proven to have problems with E15, that higher alcohol level.
Okay.
So right now, I think there's a voluntary program to go to E15.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayward, I'm mixing everybody.
It's okay.
It's late in the session.
We're ending just how we started.
Yeah, I know.
This is
familiar. We're the first and we're the last.
Some of us are getting older faster.
Yes, we are. The delivery system, the actual pump that we use, that gets the fuel out, is limited. And you'd have to change the infrastructure of the actual stations that deliver once you go above E10. So it's not that it can't be done, and it's not that certain vehicles, especially the modern vehicles, can't run on the stuff. It does maybe cut your gas mileage a little bit, or fuel mileage a little bit. It's not really gas, but it can be done. It's just expensive.
Any other questions for this panel? Don't say anything. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, we have Jana Gastelum, Gavin Carpenter, and Meredith Shield. And next up will be Jeff Bissonette and Hillary Barber.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gastelum. I'm the Climate Program Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. And since I'm pregnant, I guess I get to speak for two people today, right? I get double my time. I wanted to address the repeal of the Clean Fuels Program and our concerns with that. The main concern is that the replacement is less effective and more expensive. The replacement package costs between $270 to $370 million more than the Clean Fuels Program, which currently costs the state next to nothing. $270 million is more than what full-day kindergarten costs for the entire state of Oregon. The replacement package also has carbon savings that are based on false promises. The only, quote, certain reductions are really only the 2.5 million metric tons in the blending requirement. But even that is questionable given the new hurdles imposed on the renewable fuels sector. There are no less than over a dozen new requirements for proving what is commercially available for fuels that are already made and sold in Oregon. That is inefficient government. Redirecting the public purpose charge is also robbing Peter to pay Paul and can't be counted as additional pollution reductions. Those funds already reduce climate pollution through investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy programs, and especially the renewable energy programs are fully subscribed for years into the future. And if we redirect those funds, we may have to break contracts with existing small businesses here in Oregon. Under the replacement, the oil industry can actually pollute more. It does not require the oil industry to report on their sources of oil or the carbon impact of petroleum fuels. And any emission savings from this program in the replacement could be lost if oil companies begin importing more tar sands, which are already appearing in our fuel mix. Voluntary incentive programs also don't guarantee savings. They hold no one accountable unless they're coupled with requirements, which this package really doesn't have. And while we're not opposed to investments in transportation operations, the greenhouse gas savings can't necessarily be counted on. In fact, the Federal Highway Administration states that these savings are largely inconclusive. And that's because if you increase system efficiencies, you can actually increase greenhouse gases by putting more cars back on the road. And there are things like, while ramp signals may help traffic flow on highways, they create more idling on the ramps themselves, making that 2.02 million metric tons of pollution savings very questionable on that piece of the bill. The replacement is also not good government. There now, again, it introduces new hurdles for Oregon businesses who are already creating and producing clean fuels in the state, as well as producers around the region. Those same hurdles aren't imposed equally. Oil companies don't have to meet any cost-effectiveness standards. And it also chooses winners and losers. It pre-selects market segments, such as school buses for propane, when we know that businesses are best at choosing their own sweet spots. That's also inefficient and doesn't guarantee as high a level of reductions as the Clean Fuels Program could provide. The Clean Fuels Program was publicly vetted for over 7 years. This replacement package was cobbled together in secret in a matter of weeks. It puts the interest of out-of-state oil companies above Oregon-based businesses. And this is exactly why the public starts to lose confidence in this legislature. Indeed, there's a citizen letter published yesterday in the Statesman Journal, and this is how the public is viewing it. The oil industry is doing what it usually does, undermine the public will and legislative process with closed-door arm-twisting. The oil industry is just trying to undercut their clean technology competitors by rolling back this law. There's strong support for maintaining the Clean Fuels Program. It's been well-designed and well-vetted, and we oppose repealing it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Could we ask our witnesses not to impugn one another?
We can, and I was going to speak to the whole panel at the end, but and I think I was going to speak to what your point was. So,
thank you.
Yep. Either of you.
Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Meredith Shield, and I'm testifying on behalf of Pacific Ethanol today. Tom Kohler has submitted comments that are on the on OLIS for you guys to look at. He was not able to be here in person, and I will keep my comments very, very brief so you can get through everything. Pacific Ethanol Boardman's plant generates 40 million gallons of ethanol, provides 35 direct living wage job benefits, and supports more than 700 jobs servicing the production, marketing, maintenance, and operations of our plant, and provides a cleaner, low-carbon fuel alternative for transportation market. We are the leading producer and marketer of low-carbon renewable fuels in the western United States, and we are very proud of our role in Oregon's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, provide clean fuel options, and create Oregon jobs. We know that the Clean Fuels program works. It's a true market-based program that encourages innovation and reduces carbon to and least cost to consumers. And we've seen programs running successfully already in California and British Columbia. And as Jana mentioned, the Clean Fuels program was vetted. The program went through 6 years of public and transparent hearings, rulemaking, a one-year advisory committee review, and legislative debate. And we would ask that it is not repealed. Thank you.
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Gerard, my members of the committee. My name is Gavin Carpenter. I'm with Sequential Biodiesel. I wanted to address some concerns about HB 2281, specifically the biofuels blending portion. One of the main problems we see with this bill is seen in the requirement that any low-carbon fuels cost less than gas and diesel. It's an unrealistic, non-market request. Would that be when gas and diesel were $4 a gallon last summer, or would it be when they're $2 a gallon in January? One of the advantages of the Clean Fuels Program is it would diversify our fuel portfolio, and we could ease away from the volatility we see every day in the oil commodities market. This bill completely misses that mark. Regarding the 5% reduction in carbon intensity, the regulated parties can meet that requirement through additional blending of current renewable fuels. That means more money going out of state to Midwest ethanol and South American biodiesel producers. There is no incentive to develop new technologies. Investment in the clean fuels industry will be stifled and eventually shut off when investors realize they cannot rely on a bill that's been signed into law. We inherently believe low carbon fuels have greater value to our economy and our environment than petroleum-based fuels. A meager 5% reduction does not reflect any of that value. And finally, by repealing the Clean Fuels Program, you're saying that importing 3 billion gallons of fuel a year and sending $5 billion out of state is acceptable. You're saying that watching our fuel prices spike when a refinery shuts down is just fine. The real tragedy in this bill is a loud message being sent to the people of Oregon, the innovators, the pioneers, the entrepreneurs of Oregon, the student at OIT researching methods to make cellulosic ethanol from wood waste, the professor at Oregon State developing oil extraction processes from algae. By repealing the Clean Fuels Program, the message you're sending is that we're not smart enough, we're not creative enough, and we're not good enough. You're stating that a 10% reduction in carbon intensity is too hard for us. We don't have the talent to meet that demand, and the current system works just fine. The petroleum industry can do it better than us. And that's the sad part of where we are today. In trying to repeal a law and replace it with a frail appeasement, you're telling the people of Oregon you do not believe in us. I implore you to shut down this bill. Yes, please pass a transportation bill and let the Clean Fuels Program go into effect as it was originally written. Let us, the people of Oregon, show you what we can do. I promise we won't let you down. Thank you.
To Jana, what you had said earlier, we're having this public hearing so that we can bring the light of day to the amendment. I do not fault my colleagues who've been working on a transportation package for meeting. I mean, legislators meet in private daily to construct legislation and say, hey, would you support it if we did this? How about this? And then we have a hearing process, and that's what this is all about. So we do want to have, you know, a very public process and make sure that, you know, we scrub this amendment, and then we'll decide what, if anything, to do with it, or if it needs to be amended more or whatever. But I know that there are a lot of folks that, while they seem to be unified, I think, that we're in those talks, or at least partially unified in bringing this amendment forward, were very much at odds at different points during those talks. So I just, out of respect for this legislative process is difficult sometimes. So I just, while I may or may not agree with the aspects of the amendment that's brought forward, I wanted to thank the members of the work group for working to try to get something. So.
Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate that. I was quoting from a letter to the editor that was published yesterday, and that's the public perception that's out there that I wanted to share.
Okay. Thank you. Senator, what's it?
I think you, regarding the comments on the school buses and bad government, the Bend Lapine School District has converted about 40% of their fleet to propane. in order to reduce cost and also to get away from the fact that the biodiesel simply doesn't work on a cold day over there. It gels and it leaves kids stranded out on the roads and so forth, and we've got all kinds of documentation for that. But it actually reduces fuel costs by about 57% on current prices, $1.31 a gallon for propane and $3.11 for diesel. Also reduces carbon emissions, according to the Lapine School District and their gurus, by about 80%, or about 84.5 tons per bus over the lifetime of the bus. So I'm not sure how that's bad government.
My understanding, the propane industry couldn't be here today on such short notice, but I think what a lot of the businesses appreciate about the Clean Fuels Program is that it doesn't restrict them to any one transportation market segment. They can convert school buses under Clean Fuels, but they can also help the Polk County Sheriff's Department with their fleet and the Willamette Valley Transport Medical Office fleet, their van fleet as well. I think that same opportunity doesn't appear to exist under this framework, that it carves out and chooses a market segment for them.
Meredith, you had said that Pacific Ethanol, and I don't expect that you have the numbers,
yeah,
but if you could get the numbers,
sure,
for me,
mm-hmm,
you said you produce 40, Pacific Ethanol produces 40 million gallons of ethanol annually.
Mm-hmm.
Is Pacific, I would like to know more about the limiting factors. Is Pacific Ethanol running at capacity, or are they not running at capacity? And feedstock availability, mm-hmm, is the limiting factor. Is that because of price or just because just doesn't exist, or what? If you could get some more information,
I will get that
about
to you.
That,
absolutely, Chair Edwards.
Mm-hmm. I'd appreciate it. And then I have the same question for you, Gavin, with regard to Sequential.
We are currently running at capacity. We'll produce about 6.5 million gallons per year of biodiesel. our expansion is planned a lot. Much of it was based on the Clean Fuels Program going into effect. Our biggest constraint right now is feedstock. We've developed technology to take grease trap waste, which is a very low carbon feedstock, produce that into biodiesel. We're looking for a market that would value the low carbon fuels that we'd be able to produce and expand that capacity and the feedstock sources.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Yeah, Senator Johnson.
So if this bill goes into effect, does your company stop?
No.
Thank you.
Most of our product would go to California.
Jana, could you speak to so I know that you've done some analysis about carbon levels in the that are proposed in this amendment, actual carbon level reductions. So setting aside the whole issue of whether or not the on-ramp will work and will ever be able to trigger taking the next step, if it does, let's just assume that it does work. Would you say that this plan will reduce as much carbon as the Clean Fuels Program or not?
Chair, members of the committee, based on the numbers that were just put out last night, so no one's had a lot of time to look at this, it looks like with the biofuels, EV, and natural gas pieces, that adds up to about 5.14 million metric tons, maybe up to 6.14, depending on the range you look at for the blending. The Clean Fuels Program is at 7.4 to 7.7 million metric tons. So I do not think it achieves the same level of emissions reduction.
Cruz.
Except the Clean Fuels Program, the 7.7 was aspirational, and it's assuming the policy will drive science, and if it doesn't, you make up the difference by the selling of carbon credits, which doesn't solve a single problem. So how do you explain that?
That's a great question, Senator Cruz. So the carbon credits are just proof of emissions reduction. So the fuel has to be sold in Oregon in order to generate credits. So is that actually proof that the market is working, whether it's through investment in electric vehicles, investment in compressed natural gas or renewable natural gas, or other lower carbon fuels. So the program actually does guarantee those emissions reductions.
Mr. Chair, if you can't achieve the objective, then you go into the market and you buy carbon credits, which, I mean, it's just a trade-off. It's not actually a reduction. It's basically a book value is all you're creating.
Chair and members of the committee, so I think there's a misunderstanding in how the program works. So all in the Clean Fuels Program, all fuels generate credits, whether it's a biofuel or an electric vehicle or a natural gas vehicle. And so the credit market is the way the compliance works in this program, whether it's biofuels or any other fuel. And that is, again, proof of emissions reduction. So you only generate a credit if that fuel is being sold and displacing higher carbon fuels. So that's where there's accountability in the Clean Fuels Program, and that's what's lacking in the replacement package.
I will want to spend some more time, not probably in the hearing, but I would like the proponents of the bill to walk me through why they believe that the package presented to us achieves as much or greater carbon reductions as clean fuels. I've talked with opponents of it, and I think, frankly, I think that both sides may be choosing how they look at it, you know, differently to make the case. I mean, and what I've been talking with folks today, if you were let's get away from like megatons of carbon and let's deal with something that we can like conceptualize. I can conceptualize having $10 in my pocket and spending $10 every day. If I needed to spend $10 every day, and let's say I had a goal that in, you know, on by day 10, I want to reduce my daily spend by 10%. Well, I could reduce it by nothing. I could spend $10 on day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, all the way to day 10, and then on day 10 spend $9, and I have reached my goal. In total, I've spent $99. Or I could spend $9.90, $9.80, $9.70, sloping all the way down to spending $9 on the final day, and I've spent $90. I think it's $90, maybe it's $89.
$95, actually, I think.
I figured this out. I figured it out earlier. Now I'm just going for
$9 a day starting on day 1, then you're at 90.
Okay.
So, besides, Mr. Chair, now that you're engaged, you can't spend that money anyway.
So the point being, though, is that you know the language of the clean, and I wrote it down. The language of the Clean Fuels Bill says that a schedule to phase in implementation of the standards in a manner that reduces the average amount of greenhouse gas emissions per unit of fuel energy of the fuels by 10% below 2010 levels by the year 2025 or by later date if the commission determines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I mean, you could look at it on that final, you know, on that final date, you've dropped it by this percent. But if you went straight to that reduced percent in year one, then you're going to overall the total carbon reduced or money spent in this instance is going to be a lot greater than if you do it right at the last minute. And percentages versus total tons, I mean, I think the atmosphere and the physics of the atmosphere care about total tons into the atmosphere. And then there's, you know, legitimate debate about a ton not going into the atmosphere earlier is more beneficial to the environment than a ton of carbon not going into the atmosphere later. But some of this stuff, though, is getting, like, I mean, we could get this narrowed down to where it's getting really nitpicky, and either way, we're doing something good for the environment. So I'm just trying to figure out exactly what the proponents and opponents are saying, mechanism notwithstanding, because I do have concerns about the mechanism in terms of actual carbon reduction, and I will probably still continue to pursue answers to those questions from both sides. So Senator Whitsitt, then Senator Hayward.
It was my understanding that the figures came from modeling from the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Department of Energy primarily. Our group made every effort not to take information from either proponents or opponents, but trying to find the actual numbers. I mean, that's what my understanding. Second, it's amazing that you might think that anybody in this building would actually spin data.
Yeah. I'm shocked to find out this gabbling here.
And I do have a question.
Yeah.
I believe the gentleman said that he would end up sending it. He would end up selling his product to California. Specifically, why would you not be able to sell your product in Oregon?
It's not an issue of why we wouldn't be able to. It's a matter of us selling to the highest value market.
I'm sorry.
It's a matter of us selling to the highest value market. And California's low carbon fuel standard creates demand for low carbon fuels.
That would mean that they would have credits and we would not. Is that the answer?
They have an LCFS in place, correct, which values lower carbon fuels.
So your product would be subsidized in California but not in Oregon?
Our product would be valued in California, not in Oregon.
I'm sorry?
Our product would be valued in California, not in Oregon.
You're not answering the question, sir.
Well, you're presuming. Come on. I thought it was handled quite well. So I was like, that was a good comeback.
I love the waltz. I still sidestep.
Okay. So. Senator Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would say that I'm wrapping my head around how do you calculate how much, what the reduction really is, and I'm trying to learn it. And I would be very grateful for any materials that could be shared with the committee about, you know, from what, whether Senator Whitsitt or Senator Johnson or Senator Cruz, those of you who are in that group, any materials that you'd like to share with the rest of us, or Senator Edwards, when you get that information from proponents about how they're doing their calculations, the more I can learn about this, the more thoughtful I can be about it. So I would be grateful for any materials anyone can provide. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next panel up, Jeff Bissonnette and Hillary Barber, and then after them will be Craig Campbell and Drew Hagedorn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. With the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. The B7 amendment to House Bill 2281 proposes significant changes to the use of ratepayer money that's currently being used for energy efficiency in schools and to provide incentives for renewable energy projects. I'll be confining my remarks to that part of the amendment. And CUB opposes the diversion for four reasons. One, ratepayers will see higher rates while losing benefits. The funds that are proposed for diversion deliver high-value investments for ratepayers. The amendment proposes diverting all of the money dedicated to energy efficiency in schools and about 45% of money dedicated to investments in small-scale renewable resources in order to fund electric vehicle infrastructure, either by providing direct incentives to purchase electric vehicles, presumably, or installing vehicle charging infrastructure. While CUB is very supportive of the state helping to advance electric vehicles, diverting ratepayer funds away from efficiency and renewable resources will raise rates and carbon emissions from the electric system. Reduced investment in efficiency and renewables will have to be replaced, and this will raise rates. If the replacement resources are conventional, that is either from market purchases or gas generation, they will increase carbon emissions and expose PGE and Pacific Power customers to increased costs associated with meeting the U.S. EPA Clean Power Plan, and more on that in a little bit. At the same time, the investments in electric vehicles will add to electric demand, requiring additional resources, adding additional costs and carbon emissions, taking money away from investments that reduce cost to customers and diverting those dollars to investments that add cost to the utility system do not make any sense for ratepayers. Point two, the level of emission reductions could be substantially lower than expected because the amendment trades higher emissions from the electricity sector for lower emissions from the transportation sector. One of the stated goals of the drafters of the amendment is to build a package of programs that equals or increases the emissions reduction that had been expected to be achieved from the Clean Fuel Standard. The supporting documents for the amendment show that the expected emissions reduction from the electric vehicle investment that's proposed is 1.5 million metric tons of emissions. However, in our best estimate of looking at the materials available to us, it does not appear that this projection takes into account the increase in emissions that will result with the reduced investment in energy efficiency and renewables. The central question is this: will the net result of emission reductions from investment in electric vehicles offset the increase in emissions from reduced efficiency and renewables and actually reduce statewide emissions? Because the amendment is focused on transportation-related emissions, its effect on overall emissions is unknown, again, according to the material we have available to us. And like Senator Steiner Hayward, if there is additional material, we'd be appreciative to see it. However, we do have concerns that the net benefit may not be as strong. And we urge you as a committee, as the committee charged with examining this bill, to ensure that the net emissions reduction is positive before you move forward on the amendment. Third, passing this amendment may make it more difficult to comply with the Clean Power Plan. During policy discussions around coal, carbon pricing, and other energy issues this session relating to greenhouse gas emissions, legislators had a common theme: let's not do anything until the federal government adopts the final rules on its Clean Power Plan. That plan, set to be adopted later this summer by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, is intended to reduce coal use by utilities by increasing efficiency and renewables. Reducing funding for energy efficiency and renewables may make it harder to meet Oregon's emission reduction targets under that plan. If legislators did not want to make other energy changes until the final rules were adopted, they should follow that same policy logic in this case and not divert ratepayer funds from the precise investments we'll need to comply with the federal plan. Fourth, there is a better approach to greenhouse gas emission reductions. We share that goal. However, to repeal a comprehensive transportation policy that reduces emissions and replace those reductions in a piecemeal manner that may not net out the expected reductions is not the policy direction to take. Instead, the existing programs and policies must be kept in place, which is called for in the Oregon Global Warming Commission's roadmap, and comprehensive climate policy, such as a binding emissions cap or some other sort of carbon pricing, is what's needed as the next step in reducing emissions. The policy direction proposed in the B7 amendment does not advance climate policy and does not serve ratepayers. There's a bunch of other kind of more technical pieces that perhaps we can deal with in questions. I will highlight one, though, in section 55 of the proposed amendment. There is authority for the PUC to include in the public utility rates the cost of installing electric vehicle infrastructure. And then it allows for a rate of return for the depreciable life of the infrastructure. And when the utility's capital investment is fully depreciated, the public utility may gift the infrastructure to the owner of the property on which the infrastructure is located. And that is a somewhat troubling precedent to set, that ratepayers pay for a piece of infrastructure, the utility makes a return on it, and then it is given to a private individual or company. And that is, that's a, it's a troubling precedent. So I just kind of highlight that as the most important of the technical items. I can go into more if there's time. With that, I'll stop here and answer questions at appropriate time.
You want to ask a question now, or can you wait till the end of the panel? Or
your choice, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's wait till the end of the panel, and then we'll go.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, Hillary Barber with Renewable Northwest. We are a nonprofit group that advocates for renewable energy development in the four Northwest states. And I, too, will be focusing my comments on the redirection and reduction of Oregon's public purpose funds for renewable energy. The public purpose funds were passed as part of a law in 1999 under SB 1149. They served to close the gap between renewable energy costs and the other tax incentives for Oregon's public, commercial, and nonprofit entities. Beneficiaries include residential and commercial utility customers, municipalities, and irrigation districts within the IOU service territories. An example of some of the beneficiaries, we've seen the city of Gresham, the Farmers Irrigation District in the Hood River Valley, family-owned dairy operations in Dayton and Tillamook, and the Umatilla tribes are just a few examples of participants in this program over the years. They utilize solar, geothermal, biogas, small wind, and small-scale hydro resources. So these are smaller-scale renewable resources, 20 megawatts or less. The results are energy savings, cost savings, and a smaller carbon footprint for the entities that utilize the program. Renewable Northwest wholeheartedly agrees. Achieving carbon reductions from the transportation sector is important, and EVs are part of the answer, but this is not the appropriate trade-off. And it seems somewhat odd or out of place to take funds from an electricity generation savings program and redeploy them into a transportation or infrastructure-related initiative. And we, too, share the concerns with Citizens Utility Board about the potential carbon reduction benefits. The public purpose funds programs are proven to reduce carbon emissions, and they have additional benefits as well. So we're talking about reducing or eliminating an existing program that already reduces emissions and replacing that with a new program, which carries a number of assumptions and that would need to be borne out to achieve the desired overall emissions targets, reduction targets. We have not had the opportunity to do the analysis on the EV infrastructure that would achieve 1.5 million metric tons of carbon reduction savings. Quick back of the envelope that we were able to come up with last night, we think this could potentially take hundreds of thousands of EVs. We would be very interested to see the analysis that, has been done, and we'd love the chance to review that and have the opportunity to have a more extended conversation about it. Last couple of notes, the federal investment tax credit for renewables is set to expire. Right now, demand for the public purpose funds programs is anticipated to be even higher as a result of that federal incentive expiring unless Congress chooses to renew it, which we hope they will. But demand for the program already outstrips available funds, and so we think demand would continue to rise, and so this reduction would be a very significant blow to the renewable resource industry in our state. And I think in part, too, it would send the wrong signal for renewable energy businesses that are looking to do business in our state. So we would urge you to reconsider the trade-off that's in the amendment at this time, and we're happy to continue having the conversation with you about it. Thank you.
Thank you both. Senator Johnson.
Several things. The first one is it would be helpful if you would make your testimony available, both of you, to the committee staff so we could put it on OLIS. Secondly, and respectfully, I think I either misunderstood you or you misspoke, Mr. Bissonnette, because the amendment specifically deletes any subsidy for EV vehicles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I appreciate that, as I, and that's good to know. As I read that it's about the infrastructure. If that is indeed the case, and we're talking only about charging infrastructure, charging infrastructure actually doesn't reduce emissions. I haven't seen the analysis that shows the 0.5 million metric tons, but I'd be interested in seeing how the investment in the charging infrastructure leads to those emissions.
I just want to restate, Mr. Chair, what Senator Cruz said, and that is we relied for much of the modeling on Mazen Malik from Department of Revenue, formerly of ODOT, who is an expert in some of this modeling, on DEQ, on ODOT. And so this was not independent modeling created by folks working on the amendment. We turned to neutral modelers. And then the last is, I may have misunderstood you, Ms. Barber. You were talking about demand for available resources at the Energy Trust of Oregon outstrips available money?
On the renewable energy side.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. With that nuance, I understand now. I just find it interesting that ETO is giving back cash, and I was trying to reconcile that with your statement.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bissonnette, I want to take, I'm confused by something you just said, or more accurately, you said that charging stations do not reduce greenhouse gases, and I get it. That's correct. That being said, am I wrong in thinking that there's one of the barriers to using EVs is that if there are insufficient charging stations, it's really hard to be confident that you can go somewhere with an EV with a limited range? I'm not trying to be confrontational. I mean, I agree, a charging station in and of itself isn't going to reduce greenhouse gases, but you got to have the infrastructure too, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I agree with that. The issue is whether or not it's an appropriate investment for utility ratepayers to make.
That's a separate question.
It's a cost to the system, and if the goal is to, you know, have ratepayer money help reduce emissions, you know, that doesn't really, you know, it, that in itself doesn't do it. So there needs to be some other way to get people to actually buy vehicles. And if indeed there are no, you know, other incentives to help push that forward, and indeed in other parts of the bill you were significantly, not you, but the amendment proposes to significantly increase the registration fee, then it seems like you have different parts of the bill working at cross purposes to each other.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
you, Mr. Bissonnette. You seem to take exception with the gifting of the fully depreciated infrastructure to the private sector. How does that differ from a ratepayer who installs electric panels, solar panels, paid for by ETO, and then the ratepayer is, through a very high feed-in tariff, recovers the cost of those panels, and once that panel is paid for, the private sector individual owns that panel. How does that differ?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitson, it differs in a couple different ways. One is that an incentive that the ratepayer gets, they've paid into. They've paid part of the public purpose charge, they get it back. Two, they usually have a significant portion of their own money in your example, a solar array. And so the and thirdly, because the solar array, again in your example, is privately owned, the utility does not make a return on it. And so the difference here is that you have a, as I read Section 55 of the bill, you have the utility authorized to install a charging station, put that into rates, and then collect a return or a profit on that item. That and the utility only collects a return on equipment that they own, And then at the end of the depreciable life, they get to give it away for free to that individual. And that is, in all of those cases, it's very different than the situation that you described.
With respect, that appears to be largely a difference with that distinction. But hold on, I got that. Never mind.
It does seem to me, and if anybody has a different perspective, feel free to send me an email. Hasn't stopped any of you before, so. It does seem to me that if the Clean Fuels Program had a mechanism in it to allow for a certain credit to be generated through investments in EV infrastructure, to the extent that it is a cleaner power source, which would be dependent, I suppose, depend on how much coal is in that portfolio. You know, but I mean, you can figure that out mathematically, and that was a mechanism that was in the Clean Fuels Program. It seems like you could have the question about whether or not those funds should be used for it. I mean, the question about the carbon intensity or the carbon reduction value of that infrastructure can still be accounted for. That's not speaking to the question of whether or not you should use the public purpose charge funds, but I mean, if you can figure it out for one, you can figure it out for the other, it seems like. But
Mr. Chair, I think the difference is that in the Clean Fuels Program, you're generating credits and you're generating the internal resources to issue the credits, and you're not taking money that is doing sort of precisely what you want in terms of you know, reducing emissions and keeping costs low, and that's the difference here.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying there. I was really just speaking to the value of electric vehicle charging stations and how much credit they should get in a carbon reduction. So, any other questions for the panel?
Just briefly, for Mr. Bissonnette, you mentioned that you were concerned that the emissions created by generation of electricity may offset the emissions saved from electric vehicles. Well, that would seem to argue against the development of electric vehicles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, if all you did was invest in electric vehicles, yes. But what you have to do is, when you're looking at building load by adding electric vehicles, you also need to look at doing fairly substantial additional investments in energy efficiency and renewables to make sure that the system is cleaner and that you have a net reduction.
Mr. Bissonnette, I like to look at things on enterprise budget basis, where you don't taking a lot of other things in. I mean, so if you're, in your mind, does the development of electric vehicles on their own, is that offset by the increase in emissions from the production of electricity? Or is there some, it'd be interesting to quantify that argument.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, it would be interesting to quantify that argument, and I, you know, propose maybe we sit down and start to do that. But by simply putting electric vehicles on the system, it is adding load, and so. And so if you want the fullest benefit and make sure that you're not adding load to sort of the existing power mix, which is okay but not great, if you really want to make it much better, you need to do more to make that system cleaner so that you are getting the full benefit. But we can quantify that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a trade-off. There's no question about that. But I'm reluctant to bring other stuff in. I mean, we're looking at an enterprise here. Thank you.
We could go to rickshaws and Flintstone vehicles and no carbon reduction and address the obesity problem epidemic.
You have to take in the life cycle of the rubber sole tennis shoes.
That's true.
Mr. Chairman, I just conclude by saying yabba dabba doo.
Thank you. Okay. Next, we're going to go to Craig Campbell and Drew Hagedorn. And then after them, we've got a couple of folks, county commissioners that have come from a long way away. So we'll have them. Then after the county commissioners, we're going to go to 1,000 Friends and OCN. And then we've got a business panel. And then we'll just keep working through them. So, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here in support of the -B7 amendments on behalf of AAA Oregon Idaho. And I'm going to be focusing my remarks today on the transportation funding portion of the amendments that are before you. First, by starting on the need for making an investment in Oregon's roads, highways, as it relates to the need for maintenance and preservation. As you know, we passed the Jobs and Transportation Act back in 2009, which did a substantial amount of needed infrastructure development. However, as we move forward, we need to make sure that we're adequately investing in maintaining the system, because if you don't do that, the longer you wait, the greater the expenditure that you're going to have to make as that infrastructure deteriorates. House Bill 2281 with the B7 amendments would generate $206 million annually. Half of that, $61.8 million, would go to counties. $41.2 million would go to cities, so that they, too, can address their much-needed infrastructure needs, and in particular.
Can you say those numbers again?
Yes, it would $61.8 million for counties, $41.2 million for cities. And that's reflective of this bill capturing the same split between city, county, and state that was adopted by the Jobs and Transportation Act, which is a 50-30-20 split.
50-30-20, okay.
Exactly. Of the money that is retained by the state, $103 million per year, the bill breaks it out into three different categories. One-third of it is going to be used and dedicated for bonding, which generates $800 million for bonded projects. Those projects, LC went through and itemized what those projects were. That money then will be dedicated for paying off those $400 million in bonds. $50 million of those funds will be used for bridges. I'm anticipating, because several of Oregon's bridges are now weight limited and are having a rather tremendous impact on our ability to move freight on traditional routes, that there will be a lot of effort done to maintain, restore, and do some seismic retrofitting of those bridge systems so that they can once again allow the weight loads that are necessary to prevent freight from having to do large detours through areas of the state that really weren't designed to deal with heavy truck traffic. In addition, $20 million will be used for traditional maintenance and preservation on the rest of the system. And again, that's an annual amount. So it's, from that perspective, it's a good investment of your tax dollar. I think it was mentioned this package has a 2-cent plus 2-cent, 4-cent spread over a 2-year implementation amount, with an equivalent amount being raised through registration fee increase, increases for first-time car buyers. The thinking there is that if you're buying a new car, you can roll that first-time title fee into your purchase price and the process that you go for your for the getting the credit to purchase your vehicle. In addition, there is an increase in funding for electric vehicles, which is designed to bring them in line through a registration fee to what their cost-responsible requirement is. And that, what I mean by that is every one of us is supposed to be paying about the same amount when we travel each mile in the state. It's not perfect. The gas tax comes close, but there are those who don't pay the gas tax, and so this is an attempt to bring those vehicles in line with what everyone else is paying. One of the things that I think Senator Cruz mentioned earlier, that part of the package designates a certain amount for license fee increases of $10 that is taken separate from the rest of the taxes and is dedicated for the next 8 years for purposes of working on the DMV technology system. It's a much-needed project. As I think all of us would agree, IT projects in the state of Oregon are something we want to be very careful about how we proceed with. And I know that ODOT is going to work hard to make sure that happens. But it is such an antiquated system that we are losing a tremendous amount of time and effort on a system that really should have been replaced some time ago. So this is another excellent investment that is put in the bill before you. I also wanted to generally comment, and Mr. Hagedorn is going to talk much more thoroughly about transit. Between the amendments that are being put forward for this bill and other activities that are currently in play here in the legislature around Connect Oregon, investments in rail, investments in air, it's important that whenever we look at a transportation package, we look at it holistically and talk about it as a system. One of the things that we've had a great deal of difficulty in cracking has been operations and maintenance for transit, and so I'm glad that that's in here as well. I could certainly go on a lot about other specifics within the bill, and if you'd like me to go back to that after Mr. Hagedorn has spoken, I'm certainly happy to do that. But that's the general overview of what this bill does and why we're very supportive of the direction you're going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Drew Hagedorn, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Transit Association. Thanks you for the opportunity to appear this afternoon. At the outset, I'd like to thank this committee for all of its work, and in particular, the tireless effort of the group of eight that was referenced earlier that worked on this and legislative leadership. We greatly appreciate all the effort and attention to transportation. One of my roles also is on the Oregon Transportation Forum, and as you know, we're very much interested in moving forward with a critical transportation package to fund Oregon's infrastructure and promote economic development in our state. Speaking specifically to the transit components, and if you're looking at the amendment, it's on page 42 where that begins. It would produce a new tax for mass transit districts as defined under statute on employee wages of 0.00185%. And I know there's a policy backgrounder that was disseminated yesterday that speaks to how that would impact various people at different income levels, which I believe all of you have in your possession. We believe that this is a prudent step forward. I think it would be a game changer for those districts that could avail themselves of this opportunity. It would generate some $80 million per year. At least that's the estimates that we've seen thus far. So we applaud that effort. In that policy backgrounder I referenced, it was noted that there were three other public transit entities, Wilsonville, Canby, and Sandy, that could benefit from this. I was made privy to a quick legal analysis that suggested that perhaps the language in the bill as currently composed is too narrow to capture those districts. So we would suggest clarifying languages if that's the intent, and we stand at the ready to assist the committee with that. The Transit Association, of course, represents transit districts, large and small, urban and rural, throughout the state of Oregon, and all of them struggle to pull together resources to meet the transportation needs of their communities. This bill, as we understand it, would apply only to mass transit districts, and under current law, we believe that really is just TriMet in the Portland metro area and Lane Transit District in Eugene. So we would offer for this committee's consideration and the Assembly's consideration perhaps expanding that opportunity to districts not defined as mass transit districts. Those communities could, at their discretion, also avail themselves of a payroll tax on the employer side, and then under this proposed B7 also on the employee side. So thank you very much for all of your work and for the inclusion of transit in the mix. We greatly appreciate your recognition of transit's important role, and thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Bill.
Drew, I'd really like a good read on that, because in our conversations with Ledge Council, we thought it was inclusive, that would include transportation districts as well. So we would like some further analysis of that to make, because that was our intention. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that's greatly appreciated, and that's good information for us. We'll do some quick work and study on it and bring back some recommended verbiage for the committee. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Senator Rod.
Yeah, the question I have, and it'll be for Craig, is I'm trying to figure out if this is a tax increase or a tax decrease per gallon, and it's all predicated on what the cost per gallon is for the low-carbon fuel standards. Has AAA come up with a number that they feel that it's going to cost to fully implement the low-carbon fuel standards the way it is now? Because I've heard everything from nothing to a buck, and I'm kind of at a loss of what it really costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, the answer is that we probably don't have the apparatus to try to figure out what has been ranged from everything from 19 cents to a dollar something or other. The main concern that was iterated by AAA at the beginning of the session is the concern over increasing the cost to motorists without that increased cost being captured and going into the highway fund. From that perspective, this bill takes care of that issue. However, I don't have an answer to your specific question about what is our anticipated impact from the low carbon fuel standard / clean fuels program.
The chair believes that the high end estimate that's credible was 19 cents 10 years out. So not this year, not next year, or the year after, but slowly on the high side estimate. Could end up being 19 cents, 10 years out. So there's no credibility, in my opinion, to the dollar estimate that was being floated around at the beginning of the session. So is the employee tax that's contemplated in the amendment, is that being established by the legislature, or is it optional and the transit district itself uses their authority and says, okay, now that the legislature has given us this authority, we are going to institute it?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. And it's my understanding that TriMet and Lane Transit District are signed up to testify, so I'll defer somewhat to them. But my understanding is if you are a mass transit district and if you have an employer payroll tax, then you would be able, by virtue of the B7 amendments, to have an employee payroll tax analogous to the employer tax at that level that I referenced, 0.00185%.
Mr. Chair, to be clear, if you have an employer payroll tax, you shall have.
Okay.
Correct.
References that if it's only if they're elected to impose it already.
Okay, and if they haven't elected to impose it yet, but then they do elect to impose one,
yes,
does the shall apply?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, in the case of Lane Transit District and TriMet, they already do have an employer payroll tax.
Sorry, it would be automatic.
Yeah. Okay.
This is actually more of a, I'm sorry, not for you guys, but for those of you who worked so hard in putting this together, does that mean that cities like Salem, for example, that are not transit districts and have not elected to implement a payroll tax would not have the opportunity to do so under the current B7 amendments?
Correct.
So
an employer and an employee tax.
They have to have an employer and an employee tax.
Madam Chair, for those transit districts who are based on property taxes, this would not apply. If they switch over to a payroll tax and employer tax, then the employee tax would automatically apply.
Got it. As I told you, I'm in the middle of a steep learning curve here.
Mr. Chair, there's one thing that I did not but should have mentioned, and that is within the bill, we talk about raising gas taxes, we talk about raising registration fee, but there's also a commensurate increase in weight mile tax rates that reflect trucks' cost responsible portion of the tax so that they are paying their fair share rate along with automobiles. Yeah. And the rates that are in there reflect that that increase.
What's the there's been a lot of discussion about the equivalent in cents per gallon when you take when you include the registration and all that stuff and comparison to other legislative sessions. So I've heard that while this is a 4 cent per gallon over a couple of years, you know, 2 cents next year, 2 cents the year after, 4 cents, but then the fees are the equivalent of another 4 cents. Is that correct? So for a total of 8, and then I'm also told that the 2009 package was, and I can't remember if it's 6 cents, and that total equivalent was somewhere between 12 and 15.
I don't
Okay, done.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. The way this is written, it's the equivalent of an 8-cent increase. The registration fees in the first 2 cents take place right at the beginning, and so that would be the equivalent of a start of 6 cents within an added 2 cents a year later. The Jobs and Transportation Act, by comparison, generated about $300 million, where this package generates about $200 million, so that gives you a bit of a comparison.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to shift some things around a little bit from what I had just said because...
Because you're the chair and you can do that.
Well, no, I'm trying to accommodate people that are out of town and are leaving and also people that have come from a long distance. And so I'd like to call forward, before we go to the... I'd like to call forward John Carter and Ryan Deckert. Next up will be Gary Thompson, Sid Lycan, and Pete Runnels. And then after that will be Mira Shield and Christy Split.
Didn't Meredith already testify?
Different client, Thousand Friends. Oh, we've got a couple of other county commissioners we've got to work in here, too, from a distance. So. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. very nice to be here today. I'd appreciate being invited to speak on this very important topic. As you can tell, I received a present from my grandson on the East Coast, and my voice is a little bit off, so I hope you could hear me. My name is John Carter. I sit on a number of public and private boards in the state, as well as some nonprofits, but I'm here today representing the Oregon Business Council and the Oregon Business Plan, as well as in my own personal capacity because I've had a long career interest in transportation infrastructure projects. This is a very interesting bill because I think we all felt that the odds of actually getting a transportation package were very difficult in this legislature, and I want to commend the group that was able to put this package together for doing so because it's a very, very important thing for the state of Oregon and its citizens to maintain its competitive position in the global economy and to address the day-to-day needs of its businesses and its citizens. In general, I've expressed the view in the past that our generation has done a very poor job of measuring up to the responsibilities of providing for the future and for future generations in the same way that the generations that preceded us have. And so it's good to see that at least within the means that we have available to us, we're trying to correct that. I think if I didn't have that view before, certainly the testimony today has indicated that not everybody is completely happy with the package. But it's not a very, it isn't
it's probably perfect. About one third.
But it's very interesting because, you know, no bill is a perfect bill when you look at all the various interest groups that line up to advocate their particular views on it. And I'm sure from the standpoint of the business community and really from a number of the companies that I'm involved with, there are some serious issues in the bill. However, if you look at the overall intent of the bill and the manner in which it came together, it really is a representative of a remarkable product of negotiation and compromise from our legislative representatives doing exactly what we elected them to do. Perfection is the enemy of fundamental progress and necessity, and rather than pick at various aspects of the bill that we don't like, we should applaud the fact that our elected officials at the state level have been able to produce something that has not been possible at the federal level, a transportation package with bipartisan support. It does do things as part of that compromise. It changes the clean fuel standards. It's more modest in scope and funding than some would wish. and it imposes some economic burdens on the different parts of the business community. But overall, that's the story of transportation packages. And I, from a personal standpoint, as some of you know, I know Senator Johnson and I have had these conversations in the past. My career has been about transportation projects, or development, financing, and construction. A lot of very interesting ones around the world, from the Channel Tunnel to the Hong Kong Airport to others, and Portland's own light rail system. And I can say that none of these projects would have occurred without a willingness on the part of all of the parties involved to compromise and to achieve a greater goal as a result of that compromise. So on behalf of OBC and the Oregon Business Plan, I urge passage of the bill. I urge our governor to sign it. And thank you very much for the opportunity to address you.
Thank you. All right. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Ryan Deckert, the president of the Oregon Business Association. I will be concise given Mr. Carter's testimony about the importance of a transportation infrastructure package and the high priority that we place as vital to our global competitiveness and our ability to just move commerce and quality of life for Oregonians. That said, we have written a letter that's being distributed, and I was told, haven't you found email? So good note that it should be in your email inbox as well. Asking the legislature to do some of the things that Mr. Carter referenced. We were supporters of the LCFS. We will meet tomorrow at 10:30 for what I think will be a long meeting for my organization with our executive committee, our transportation committee, and our economic and environment committee, to go through the details of your work. But we did issue a public letter dated May 20th that at least asked the legislature to do what we find is the hallmarks of good policy, which is work together, find big solutions to big problems, and those tend to be, at least historically, bipartisan. And we haven't seen a great deal of that this session, and so to see opportunities to salute bipartisan work. I know that'll be a topic of discussion that I will have with, and we will have it at Oregon Business Association tomorrow, is that that is at least the effort that was underway at the governor's, in the governor's conference room, and that's the effort that you're trying and attempting to make, and it's one that tends to be the best solutions. With that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude.
Well, I appreciate the sentiment. Particularly around bipartisanship, but I think if we're going to change bipartisanship in this capital, we're going to have to change the primary system that elects us to get here. So and that's a whole other topic, and I've been unsuccessful at achieving that in my legislative tenure, and but I'm always up for the fight again. Yeah, Senator Whitsitt.
Yeah. Mr. Deckert, I'm not sure exactly what you said. Do you support this package? Does the OBA support this package as written?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, so we will meet at 10:30 a.m. tomorrow to decide that, and that's why I kept my testimony relatively brief, talked about the transportation package, which is a huge priority, but we got the details of this proposal last night. We disseminated them, I think, this morning, I look forward to...
Your testimony is neither in support or in opposition, then?
Until my board decides which... Yeah.
Is it fair to say, since... you guys were supportive of the clean fuels program, but you want a transportation package, at least at this point, before your board meets, is it fair to say that, look, people, we want a transportation package. Our support for a transportation package is not contingent upon repeal of the clean fuels. There are some folks in the Capitol that say, well, we're not doing any transportation unless we change clean fuels. Is that your position?
We reject the linkage between the two.
Right.
At the outset, we did in February, we did in March, we rejected the linkage. The fact that they could be or perhaps linked, this isn't the first rodeo of politics, that sometimes things get linked, and to the degree that you worked really hard, and I think that's the nature of the conversation we'll have tomorrow for hours, is looking at the two side-by-side proposals around transportation. But it seemed like, I can say it just looking at it, folks made, and some of them are here today that were spent hours on end, really worked hard and thought about how do you develop a transportation carbon package that at least is very serious. Mm-hmm. And so I think that'll be the nature of our discussion.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Deckard, if the goal is overall carbon reduction and it is achieved through a different methodology, OBA's support of 324 notwithstanding, the prize is the carbon reduction. Is your board looking specifically at the iconic image of 324, or is it looking, do you think it will look at overall carbon reduction?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson. So that's been the nature of, I mean, I'm just going off of the emails I've read since everything was disseminated. I think the focus of the conversation that I've seen has been around what you just said, which is a four a four. That I was taking notes in the testimony, I think, at the second panel you had where you got deeper into, are we really talking apples to apples in terms of carbon reduction from the transportation sector? And that's been the nature of conversation I've observed within the organization I represent is are we getting equal, you can debate equal, are we getting like results and just doing it in a different manner? Without getting ahead of my bosses and board, I think that's the nature of conversation they want to have is can we get the outcomes that we all want as a society and do it in a way that's more ecumenical perhaps and actually delivers a big transportation or at least a medium-sized transportation package, but these are very difficult, and we haven't been able to do one for years. So,
yeah.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up, I would invite your scrutiny on the metrics on both sides. I again want to emphasize the fact that none of us that worked on this felt independently adequate to do the modeling, and we turned to the best available state modelers across agencies that we could find, and that's the genesis of the numbers here.
Yeah. I do think, I mean, if there's one thing that we can add, hopefully tomorrow and the next day, is we have a bunch of folks that are just non-political, probably couldn't find the capital. They could, but it'd take them a while. But they're decent about numbers and about metrics, and so I'm interested to see, because they're really diving in to this, and I'm kind of curious where they land.
I would commend for their consideration at least conversations with the folks that we used, we're happy to provide the names. Mazen Malik, Palmer from DEQ. We'll give you all the names,
right.
And at least then the modeling experts can have a conversation one to another.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. We've connected with one of the names that you mentioned, but we should make sure that it's so whatever, experts talking to experts independently.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. During my time in the legislature, I've aged significantly. I'm wondering why Ryan still looks the same age. It's just, I don't understand that.
Because he got out of the legislature.
He did get out of the legislature.
Okay. Thank you both. Next, we're going to go to Gary Thompson, Sid Lycan, and Pete Runnels.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. I am Pete Runnels, Harney County Commissioner and business owner. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2281-B7, the transportation package. I appreciate the hard work it took to create this package. I support the package and my constituents in Harney County. What it means to Harney County, where we have 945 miles of county roads, safe access, safe transportation for local businesses to bring goods in and goods out. Currently, we receive only about $623,000 to maintain the roads. The package will bring an estimated $168,000 to the road department. This may not sound like a lot here in Salem, but it means a great deal to us. We have half of our road crew that we had when timber receipts were plentiful in the 80s. The loss of secure rural schools looms in our near future, and this will help make up some of that. Bonded projects include $7 million for the Gentura cutoff road. Repair of this road leads to a mine that will allow retention and expansion of business in our frontier area, and that would be a positive impact to Harney and Malheur counties. And also, we have a small amount of registered vehicles in our large county, and the help that we can receive from this we greatly support. And I thank you for your time and commitment. And Chair Edwards, if there are no questions for me, I may be excused. I have a 3 o'clock testimony in another room.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Is this on?
Okay. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Gary Thompson. I'm a Sherman County judge, also current president of Oregon Association of County. You have a letter that I submitted to you for testimony. I won't go into that. I'll let you read it. But in the meantime, I really commend the group of eight for doing a well-thought-out, comprehensive approach to a transportation funding. It's something that's – I'm going off script here, so hopefully I don't get in too much trouble. It's something that's not very often –
If I tug my ear, that's a signal that you might want to –
Yeah, all right. It's something that's not seen very often in Salem. While trying to achieve the carbon fuel reductions in Oregon, I have to admit, I've just got the bill just recently and haven't gone through it all. I think an important part of the package to the counties is the comprehensive transportation is the $61.8 million that's going to go to the counties annually. And I think that's important. And I want to really I really appreciate staying with the 50-30-20 program. That's a plus. And even though that's still going to be over a $500 million shortfall to the counties because of the timber revenue shortage. Now, I'm also, I don't know if you know, Sherman County is the heart of the renewable energy area of Oregon, and I've just been trying to figure out what all it says to do, how this bill is going to affect the renewable energy in Oregon. There's a whole mess of other things going on down here that's going to affect it even more than this bill will, I think. So I'm so in favor of what I've read to date. I'm in favor of the way this carbon fuel thing is being handled. There are some tweaks that's probably going to be needed, but I think it's being handled quite well, considering. So that's my testimony.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, member of the committee, my name is Sid Lykin, and I serve on the Lane County Board of Commissioners. And Chair Edwards is actually one of our senators in Lane County, along with my direct senator, Senator Beyer. And I come to you really in my capacity as co-chair of the Association of Oregon County's Transportation Committee. And myself, Commissioner Mike Weimer from Gillam County, and our co-chairs, Mark Labart from Tillamook County. So as you can see, we have Eastern Oregon, we have the Valley and urban area, plus the coast as part of the leadership that President Thompson asked the three of us to be the leaders of that committee. So we're here to support the Dash 7 amendments and really want to say thank you to the Gang of Eight. But Chair Edwards, thank you for having this public hearing as well. And I think to hear the testimony from various groups. I think what you have before is the transportation has been one of the top priorities for the counties, and for various reasons. I mean, as we've heard from the testimony, Lane County is one of those counties as described as the timber count, one of the timber counties. And when that's broken down, it's actually U.S. Forest Service money when it comes into those counties. Those are the dollars that are specifically used for road funds. Lane County was, as a county, annually, when you had the harvest from publicly owned lands, would receive between $20 and $25 million annually. And prior to serving the Lane County Board of Commissioners, I had the opportunity to serve as the mayor of the city of Springfield. And talk about transportation investment. When you look at the Gateway area itself, you look at total transportation investment somewhere between $40 and $50 million. That is equal to about $1.5 billion of private sector investment and about 10,000 jobs over the course of about 20 years. So this is why we feel that the transportation package is so important. It's important to the cities, but for the counties. And again, Lane County, roughly the size of Connecticut, we have about 1,500 miles of roads. We have 417 bridges, and so just that $6 billion investment is important for us just to maintain. And right now, the check we received on Secure Rural Schools, I talked to you about $20 to $25 million, just under $6 million. And so those dollars continue to decrease. So at this time, we rely on the state to come forward with a package that will be important. Mary Stern, our ALC transportation lobbyist has also put together a letter. She asked specific, so each county, this will be as part of the package. She'll get to see the breakdown of each county and the revenue that will, as far as new money, it will be coming in. So this is important to us. We really appreciate, appreciate your having this public hearing, and thank you very much.
Thank you both. Any questions for the panel? Thank you. Next, we're going to go to Meredith Shield and Christy Split, and then after that, John Ludlow and Paul Savas.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Split. I'm here today representing both the Oregon League of Conservation Voters and the Oregon Conservation Network, Oregon's Environmental Coalition. OCN has over 40 member organizations, and those organizations have hundreds of thousands of members throughout Oregon. In 2015, both the Sustainable Transportation Package and the Clean Fuels Program are priorities for a healthy Oregon for OCN. You can imagine that the end of this session has been really interesting for me and for all of us that are part of OCN.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Today I am forced to testify vehemently against House Bill 2281 and the B7 amendments. Repealing the Clean Fuels Program is not in the best interest of Oregon nor for her residents. In particular, I want to talk about our children. We spend a lot of time in this building, as we should, considering how to best provide for Oregon kids. Whether it's school funding, improvements to employment-related daycare, I almost cried in the Ways and Means Subcommittee listening to that testimony last week, or reducing toxics. We come together to do the right thing for our kids. To me, the Clean Fuels Program is also about our kids. It's about improving air quality in the short term, and it's about being part of a larger global effort to address climate change in the long term. The replacement package just doesn't add up. And the overall package shortchanges kids too. By taking money from the Energy Trust of Oregon's program for schools, Portland Public Schools will lose the $800,000 per year they leverage for $1 million in energy savings under that program. Sorry, thanks. I don't testify that often. You know it's important when I testify because I don't really know what I'm doing. For 7 years, I've been involved in creating a clean fuels program for Oregon. The 7 years, I've been around for pretty much since the beginning of all of this and in a lot of the rooms where the conversations have taken place. What happened was people came together and found a program that could work for rural Oregon and for Oregon businesses. They found the most efficient and least expensive way to get a 10% emissions reduction in our transportation sector. Legislators agreed. They agreed twice. It's been just 3 months, and here we are pondering repeal because of political brinkmanship. We all want a transportation package. $80 million for transit. I want to be up on this table jumping for joy about that. this is a real bummer. There could have been a chance for a win-win here today, and it's not me and it's not my community preventing that. In 20 years, I want to feel like we have done the right thing for our children and grandchildren. This is a legacy vote that you will make on this committee, and I have faith you will consider our future generations in making your choices. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Ms. Split, I don't expect you to have an instant answer to this question, although you may have some now. I would be really interested to know, short of leaving Clean Fuels exactly the way it is and doing the transportation package exactly the way it is, although there may be some pieces of it you don't like, what could OLCV, OCN, frankly, any of the groups concerned with the clean fuel side of this see as a path that would potentially make some changes to address some of the concerns about 324 as we passed it, while still allowing us to move forward potentially on the transportation side?
Right, I appreciate that you understand that it's a complicated answer. I run a coalition and I talk to about 60 people before I make decisions or public statements.
Yes.
But this is what I can say. You just heard me talk about 7 years of hard work on this program and the realization that this, the Clean Fuels program, was the best way to both achieve our greenhouse gas emission targets and jumpstart innovation and entrepreneurship in Oregon. So it's hard for us to say, let's back away from that, because we figured out that was the most efficient, most cost-effective, and best way to get there. But now let's just start from scratch. We are hearing from the other side that they need absolute repeal. That doesn't give us a position to negotiate on, because they're saying they need absolute repeal to move forward. And if we were hearing that there was any movement on the other side towards some sort of compromise, maybe then we could sit down and talk. But I don't think that that moment has ever come. Our understanding is that in order to get support of a supermajority in both chambers, a repeal is required.
Can I ask my question in a slightly different way, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I mean, I think what you just told me, Ms. Split, was useful, but I want to ask a different sense. Are there any parts of what's proposed in terms of the carbon reduction part? I don't even want to talk about fuels. I want to talk about carbon reduction,
mm-hmm.
right? Because ultimately, I think that's our goal, right? And there are a lot of different ways to skin that cat.
I'm not sure that there are to be cost-effective and efficient.
Okay, then I'm not even going to bother asking my question. Thanks. If you don't think there are any other ways, then there aren't. I mean, I was going to ask you whether there's anything in the proposal that's in there that you think is worth considering, but my guess is the answer is no, based on what you just said. So
well,
never mind.
Chair Edwards and Senator Steinberg Hayward, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sort of interrupt there at all. I just got into the conversation for a minute. We've had a lot of conversations thinking and talking about this policy proposal since we first heard bits and pieces of it starting to come out last week. And I think what I'd like to say is that we saw something that we felt like we could work with. And I think that the policy experts in our community haven't seen that there is a lot there. And the more we kind of poke into it, the more we see problems with those emissions numbers actually adding up. But thank you for your question.
Appreciate
and we'll continue to talk, and I'll continue to get more information your way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Meredith Shield. I'm putting on my land use hat now, working with Thousand Friends of Oregon. I will keep my comments brief. We have submitted testimony online. Also want to mention that a group of nonprofits that work in this field has also submitted testimony from Thousand Friends of Oregon, the Oregon Environmental Council, Opal Environmental Justice, BTA, and you can find that as well. Thousand Friends of Oregon is a board member of the Oregon Transportation Forum, a very broad-based nonprofit organization made up of over 40 members, ranging from local governments, AAA, BTA. We are focused on transportation package that ensures funding mechanisms and policy changes that will create safer neighborhoods with better access to jobs, services, schools, healthy food, and recreation. While we appreciate the bipartisan group of legislators proposed the package that includes dedicated source of funding for transit, which is very important for us, something that we know that Oregon sorely leads, we have some concerns with the package that it's not balanced. We feel that it will unfairly shift the burden of paying for public good transit to employees. We're concerned that it would only fund a handful of transit districts, those in the Portland metropolitan and Eugene-Springfield areas. And we're concerned that the proposal will not help transit Oregon's other six metropolitan regions or rural areas, which which we know also need transit services and enhance access to jobs and services that it supports. We're also concerned that the proposed tax would be a percentage of one wages, which would hit lower and middle income workers harder than higher income ones. And we want to talk a little bit about the funding for Connect Oregon and its bicycle and pedestrian elements that are not included in the Dash B7 amendments and the funding level proposed in other bills this session that we don't feel is adequate. We have, again, we've submitted testimony online that also lists some more of our concerns. We want a transportation system that is truly multimodal, fairly funded, and serves all Oregonians, and that's essential to the long-term sustainability of Oregon, and that we want to see a transportation package that serves all of these goals. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. In the interest of accuracy, you've left the impression, I think, that respectfully, that bicycle and pedestrian has been cut out of Connect Oregon, and that is categorically not the case.
Okay. I appreciate that. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
Well, so actually, I would like clarification. Did you say it's not at the level that you would like to see, or did you say that it was not included?
The funding level proposed is not adequate in the Connect Oregon piece.
Okay. But not left out. So,
Well, again, this bill doesn't set the funding level for Connect. That came through the governor's budget and then through the co-chair's budget and now through final negotiations because that money is all bonded.
Okay.
And so this bill doesn't speak to the levels. It's the level allowed by the legislature in the final budget negotiations. Okay. Now estimated, the number's been bouncing around, now estimated somewhere between 58 and 65 million. And as you know, other packages have been richer. Other packages have been less robust. But there's been no change to the there's been no exclusion of bike ped.
Thank you. Sorry if I misspoke.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioners Chair John Ludlow and Commissioner Paul Savas.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Ludlow. I'm chair of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today on behalf of the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners to voice our interest in and serious concerns with the proposed transportation package. At the outset, I would like to express our complete appreciation to the legislature for focusing on this issue about the future of Oregon's transportation needs. For perspective, Clackamas County has more than 1,400 miles of road, and that's like driving from Portland to Mexico. With nearly 400,000 residents and as part of a larger Portland metropolitan region, these roads experience a lot of traffic and a lot of wear and tear. The current funding model just to maintain our roads are falling well short of the needs, and Clackamas County currently needs about $17 million a year just to maintain current service levels and for paving and preservation projects. Over the last year, we've worked hard to educate the public on the maintenance funding needs. Just yesterday, we learned from a scientific survey that the public in Clackamas County believes the roads are in good condition and not in need of repair. While this is kudos to our road department, what we actually know is that 56 of our roads are in fair to poor condition. If funding conditions remain the same, we expect that roughly 80% of our roads will degrade to fair or poor condition in a relatively short period of time. For this reason, we would very much appreciate this bill's, we do appreciate the allocation of $61.8 million for counties, which translates into more than $6 million for Clackamas County. This will go a long way to addressing our maintenance needs. In addition, we are encouraged to see the bill set aside funding for the study, at least, of adding lanes to the southern stretch of 205. As many of you know, that's a 37-mile long freeway, and it's only 5.8 miles. It's two lanes in each direction, and we're unlucky enough to have that in Clackamas County. As you may know, this is the last stretch of the interstate in the region to have two lanes in each direction. Most of us in this room have probably experienced congestion on I-205, and we believe the project is desperately needed, not just for Clackamas County, but for the region and the state. Unfortunately, we were distraught to see a mere $3 million allocated for this project, which would pay only a portion of the environmental impact study on the project. Moreover, the funding is to be spent within Clackamas County represents only 2% of the total funding allocation for the metro region, 2%. We've been shortchanged before in Clackamas County. We believe this poses a significant imbalance, and we respectfully ask that the funds be reallocated to more equitably distribute them to projects across the metro region instead of being so Portland-centric. In addition, the bill suggests tolling as a possible way to pay for the expansion of I-205. We implore you to remove this language from the bill, which we believe is premature and in need of significant conversation at a later time when the project moves closer to reality. Tolling the I-205 lane expansion project presents unintended consequences, such as diversion to already congested I-5 and to local roads in West Lynn and Oregon City. And now is not the time to float this idea that has not been part of the discussion for many years. Lastly, as the only two-lane stretch of freeway in the metro area, we would argue that tolling would penalize the residents of Clackamas County who use this roadway on a daily basis, while residents elsewhere in the region already have completed facilities without tolls. In closing, thank you for your work to address local transportation funding. We strongly encourage you to more adequately and equitably distribute funding to for projects in the ODOT Region 1, provide us at least $10 million to cover the EIS for I-205 expansion, and remove the mention of tolling at this early stage of the project. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yeah.
The tolling portion is a study at this point in time, and it's not restricted just to 205.
I didn't read that. So I-5 too? So we'd both get pain, huh?
it's a comprehensive look. And at this point, it's a study.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Cruz. Mr. Chair, again, the environmental impact study is so important to start this project. And it takes a little while in itself, of course. And then the funding of that is a whole other equation. We all know that. But at least to get that portion started would be really eminent, we think. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Commissioner Paul Savas, representing the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak here today. I want to express my appreciation to the committee for taking this on. I wish it was earlier in the session so we'd have more time to actually thoughtfully look at ways to actually implement both the goals of the clean air, the clean fuels thing for clean air and for the benefit of transportation projects. I do want to speak specifically to a few. I'm going to go off script here and speak to an equity issue. And my colleague has expressed some concerns about that. As a member of Connect Oregon, a member of JPACT, I'm the transportation liaison on the commission to the region, representing Clackamas County. So I've sat on a number of committees, and I do expect at times that we'll come away from a table such as Connect Oregon with maybe $0, which was the case recently. And I expect that at some points in time, maybe we'll benefit. This is one situation, I think, where I would like to see some reciprocal consideration as far as equity in the region. My staff has put together a suggestion that we be raised the Region 1. Now, there's equity in the regions, Region 1 compared to Region 2, for example. I don't have the stats before me today to talk about the population of the two regions versus, and also consideration of what the vehicle registration is in those two regions. But I suspect that Region 1 is perhaps the most populous and has probably the most vehicles. So we're requesting consideration of raising the amount to Region 1 to $157 million, and 41% of that going to Multnomah County, 28% to Washington County, and 25% to Clackamas County, and leaving 4% to Hood River County. That would cover a more equitable distribution of those dollars. I'm going to go off script here. It's kind of interesting for me to have a different perspective sitting in the room today. My background, I was part of a pilot project on the ethanol standards implemented in a pilot project in 1977. I've been in the automotive clean air industry my entire life. I took the role of a commissioner in 2010, and so I have a unique perspective here. I have implemented and been part of meeting the DEQ standards. I feel I'm a steward of clean air. At the same time, reasonable and mechanical and practical solutions actually towards achieving that. I think, you know, in light of the previous speakers that were here, I think there is some middle ground. I think that you have to look at transportation projects that improve traffic flow. It's a very simple concept. If you improve traffic flow, You will reduce emissions. You will reduce the cost to the consumer. You'll reduce the carbon output. And I think that has been underestimated. And I think the benefit of the Clean Fuels Act, as far as the fuel standards, how much ethanol is mixed, has been overestimated as far as the benefit. There's a long term, there's a midterm, and there's a short term evaluation, and they differ. They differ significantly. Being in the industry and seeing those systems fail when those standards have been risen, and being experimenting in the line of work that I have, I have experienced those failures, and those failures cost the consumer money. If we care about the consumer, we will look at all of those factors. Again, I wish we were earlier in the session. I would love to provide more data, information, and experience to you all, but the message here today is really about equity. And I would hope you really seriously consider that.
Thank you.
Happy to take any questions.
Senator Johnson.
I think all of us wish that this was earlier in the session. Frankly, had the rush to judgment not occurred on Senate Bill 324, and had we have had the opportunity to have the kind of dialogue that we're having right now on that bill, we could have conceivably started this much earlier.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Is Matt Garrett still here? Signed up. I don't see him. Okay. Why don't you check if he's here? And Aaron Dees and Edward McLone. TriMet and LTD. Okay. TriMet, LTD, and Director Garrett. I know you guys did not sign up together, but. We're just trying to fill chairs and get as many people through as we can. So.
That guy looks familiar. I think we've seen him somewhere before.
Okay. Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And over the course of the conversation, I think both Ms. Elliott of the legislative counsel's office, as well as Mr. Campbell, pretty much articulated the basics, the constructs, the framework that we had worked in terms of the transportation portion of House Bill 2281. So, Mr. Chair, I don't want to be redundant. What I can say, and Mr. Campbell did a good job of articulating this, if you look at the breakdown, we're honoring the 50-30-20 commitment with our city and county partners. As you look at the flow of money that comes to the Oregon Department of Transportation, the $103 million, you will note that two-thirds of it does go to preserving the system. That's consistent with where my agency and where my commission and the policies that underpin the agency goes. We have to take care of that multi-billion dollar asset then. So $70 million going to bridges, pavements, and culverts. And I will tell you, we've articulated the number of bridges as we look at $50 million. What that will do over a 20-year period is secure 74 bridges across the state of Oregon, critical bridges that have economic import to the state, lifelines, making sure that we aren't stranding folks. And then at the appropriate junctures when we replace those bridges, we will strengthen the seismic resiliency, because that is a threat. The geological clock is ticking. So 74 projects specific to bridges playing themselves out over a 20-year period. As you move to the preservation side, again, $20 million directed to three categories of investment: pavements, culverts, and safety overall. And what we see is an opportunity to send the majority of that, half of it at least, $10 million to pavements. And what that will allow us to do over the next 10 years is pave an additional 300 lane miles on top of what we do right now. So again, ensuring that the condition doesn't continue to decline as we look out into the future here. And then we'd make investments in culverts as well as safety investments, the cable barrier, rumble strips, ensuring that as people travel the highways and byways across this state, they are as safe as possible. And then it breaks it down to $33 million, the remaining third going toward bonded projects. And the rule of thumb with bonding is you take the amount of revenue and you times it by 12. That's where we get this $400 million level of bonding proceeds that will come from the $33 million. In Section 18 of the bill here, we have 30 projects identified. I heard the commissioner from Clackamas County saying, boy, we can do things a little bit differently, can't we? But we do have those projects broken out across the ODOT regions, regions 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Those are articulated in the bill. We have done our very best to ensure that we have embedded operational efficiencies as well as safety, as well as freight mobility, ensuring that there is a link between transportation, health, and the economic health of the state of Oregon here. So I think with that, Mr. Chair, I think anything else I would say would probably be redundant. But I have one thing I must say, because I'd be remiss if I didn't, because we have to correct a mistake. Early in the conversation, there was a suggestion questioning the reduction in terms of transportation. There's two components specific to greenhouse gas reductions. And this is what we worked over the course of a couple weeks. But there was a mistake made, not for transit. That $80 million identified through that employee tax, that does yield that 1.66 million metric tons of greenhouse gas reductions. But specific to operations, once we got the list of projects and we looked through those 30 projects, the operational aspects of those total about $174 million, just a little bit above. When we ran the model on that, it does not yield 2.02 million metric tons. It yields 0.43, so that is quite a reduction. But I think it's incumbent upon me to make sure that as we move forward in this conversation, the platform and the assumptions are validated. And we made a mistake. I'm not sure how 2.02 got out there. But I just had my modelers rerun the 30 projects identified in Section 18. And it yields that reduction in greenhouse gas emissions here. So while I apologize for that, it's a mistake that I need to correct, I will own. But it does go into part of this conversation, and it's best to put it on the table right now and move forward from there.
Thank you. Let's get through them all, then we'll have questions. So, Edward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. Edward McLone, Government Relations Manager for Lane Transit District in the Eugene-Springfield area. I wanted to first thank you all for what I suppose is half-heartedly volunteering or being forced to serve on a very challenging committee. And for those of you who participated in the group of eight, thank you for your hard work. We know there was a lot of time and effort that went into this to reach a bipartisan agreement, at least on one chamber, and come close to a deal across both. And so we really appreciate that. I wanted just to very briefly speak to the transit component of this. There are a couple of important notes that I'd like to make. The first is the value of the investment in transit. Oregon as a state provides about 3% of operating dollars for transit. The national average is 24%, so we're far behind our peers. Despite that fact, LTD has been ranked the top transit agency in the country for the past year, and I believe TriMet held that distinction not long ago as well. So we do our best as locals, but we appreciate this significant investment in transit. For low-income Oregonians, this is possibly the most important investment in transportation infrastructure that this package does. Two-thirds of LTD riders make $25,000 a year or less. For them, when we increase our fares due to insufficient funding, for instance, 2 years ago, we raised fares by 25 cents, they really feel the pinch. The difference for this in this package, for those two-thirds of our riders who make that low level of income, a 25-cent fare increase is the equivalent of $10 a month added to their monthly bills. The way that the proposal works for transit funding here instead is those people would be paying something closer to $3.85 a month. So for LTD's low-income riders, this is a much less expensive way to drastically more increase the level of service. With the $7 million or so generated by this tax as proposed, LTD would be able to make an investment up to 45% in service along our core routes, which could yield a very significant greenhouse gas reduction, including the equivalent of removing 1,400 vehicles from the road, displacing 16 million passenger miles driven, and over 750,000 gallons of gas consumed every single year. So we appreciate the vision that this group has taken to find a unique solution to a challenging problem of transit operating dollars, and stand by willing to do everything we can to support that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll wait until they're done. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Dees. I'm the government affairs manager at TriMet. Edward stole all of my thunder. I mainly came up here because Drew Hagedorn and Craig Campbell also did a very good job of representing, and I appreciate your comments, Senator Cruz. And to reinforce what Edward says, of all of TriMet's rides, 42% of them are low income, and that's 150% of poverty. So mainly I wanted to come here and answer questions if you had them, follow-up questions or about what we would do with service. I don't want to take too much of your time because I realize we're in overtime. So
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
I think I'm fine. I just got a little tiny bit lost in your testimony, and you concluded at the end by saying you're supportive and that the folks paying would get value for the increased employee charges.
That's correct, Senator Johnson, members of the committee. From our perspective, this is the most value you can get for your buck.
Thank you. That's what I needed to hear.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would also, I'm assuming, although you didn't say it, TriMet is in the same position of supporting,
yes,
correct?
Yes, we strongly support.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Steiner Hayward, then Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garrett, we heard from Commissioner Ludlow, and I've heard from other people when looking at this list of projects that have been proposed, that the amounts proposed really only cover parts of the estimated cost for these projects. Commissioner Ludlow said the $3 million allotted for the 205 piece would basically just cover the environmental impact statement. I've heard from the City of Portland that the amount proposed for the Powell Boulevard stretch really only covers a fraction of that. Could you help us understand, if you do, what the plan is for actually, because getting part of the money for a big construction project is probably not much better than getting no money for a big construction project like that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's a fair question. The two projects you speak to, or the commissioners and the good folks from the City of Portland spoke to, are significant projects. One carries a price tag of $275 million. The other one, somewhere between 70 and 90. What you do is you segment them, you phase them, and you break them out into standalone phases of projects that have standalone utilities. And that's the way you break things forward. Specific to the Clackamas County issue, I think the commissioner is right. I think if you want to move, we're really at the front end of that conversation. It's a very complicated project. It's got many moving parts. I think that was acknowledged by the legislators in the room. That's why they said, hey, let's jump start it at 3. I think the real cost is 16, because in talking with the legislators, what they want to do is animate not only the planning portion of it, but taking it through NEPA, and then, as Senator Cruz articulated, and then position it for an opportunity, a public-private partnership, where the tolling conversation comes in. And that becomes the revenue source to pay for a project that is, like I say, triple digit in its size. So those were part of the conversations. But what we try to do is ensure that we can sequence and phase projects so they have standalone utility, and then take them on in bite size. The problem is, it is a symptom of the size of the package, to be very honest with you. As we condense down to that $206 million level, that's just what we can do, and that's what yielded the 30 different projects embedded in this bill.
Quick follow-up, yeah. Mr. Chair. And Mr. Garrett, help me understand, and maybe people who are on the work group can also help me understand this. These projects were picked specifically how?
So it was really a refining process. So back in February, there was an initial conversation with a group of legislators, and we were asked to bring in a universe of projects that totaled into the billions, to be very honest with you, broken down by the ODOT regions. From that greater, first of all, that list is informed by our professionals, our region managers, as they engage you and your colleagues, legislators, as they engage the area commissions on transportation, really the grassroots folks that help prioritize and focus the transportation conversation across the state, businesses, just basic citizens. All that input was placed into that big document, and that's what we brought into the room. From there, there was a refining process where we created a document that had tiers, projects tier 1, tier 2, so there could be some movement in terms. And then finally, The next refinement actually brings us to where we are today in terms of the 30 projects that are embedded in Section 16 of this bill.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, may I ask Mr. McGlone a quick question? Would you prefer that I wait? Okay, thank you. Mr. McGlone, I appreciate your point entirely and Mr. D's your point entirely about the importance of a robust public transit infrastructure, especially for lower-income families. I'm having a little trouble with the arithmetic, and I want to see where I'm falling down. You said that a 25-cent increase in the fare is a $10 a month charge. If I do my arithmetic correctly, that's 50 cents a day, even if you assume they use it 30 days a month, I don't get $10. I get either 15, or if they're using 20, that's 10. Is that what you're talking about? The only 20 work days?
Yes, Senator, thank you. I didn't show my math. What I did was I calculated that at 25 cents on the way into work on Monday and 25 cents back.
Got that far.
5 days a week for 4 weeks.
Okay, thank you.
So that should get you close to $2, you know, close to $2.50 a week.
Right, okay.
Times 4 weeks is $10.
All right, thanks. Because the math that I understand it works out is $34,000 your annual salary puts it at $524 a month. So it's definitely a reduction, but there's still a cut that comes to people's salaries.
Correct.
I mean, I think it's a good investment. Don't get me wrong. I always support investment in public transit, but just want to clarify. Thank you.
I just want to amplify Mr. Garrett's response to Senator Steiner Hayward's question about the projects. These weren't just picked out of the air. This came through a really laborious winnowing of lists developed by ODOT of projects that are already under consideration, have been lifted up from the locals. It was a sizable document with emphasis on an attempt to get some geographic equity. And so I just want to underscore the amount of time that went into culling those lists.
Thank you, Senator.
Ms. Chair, just to follow up on Senator Johnson, for example, in Region 3, we actually went to Tier 3 for one of the projects, and that was in consultation with county commissioners in the Port of Coos Bay as far as the freight route is why we went to 42 on that. So.
Thank you.
We tried to prioritize getting as much input as we could.
Senator, what's it?
Thank you, Chair Edwards, for the TriMet. Would you say that this bill will be good for the low-income riders on TriMet as well?
Yes.
Thank you. And a second question. Okay. Mr. Garrett, the 80% change in that assumption is fascinating. And we don't need to do it here, but I would like to know what models are always based on assumptions. And there must have been a humongous change in assumptions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I think there was just a mistake. And I'm not sure where the mistake took place. But I can assure you that the confidence level, both for the transit number as well as the operation numbers now, are very high. And that's coming from my modeling professionals who are nationally recognized. So I would just say, it was a mistake, sir. I mean, no ill intent. It was just a mistake, and it was documented, and I know people are reacting to it. But I thought, boy, now's the time to jump on this and just let it be known. I wish I had better news. I do. But it was just a mistake, sir, and we corrected that mistake.
Any other questions for the panel? Seeing none. Thank you each.
Thank you very much.
Next up, Carrie Nysine, Jamie Painter, and David Brown.
Interesting that both of the largest transit districts.
And at some point, I don't know how much longer that the committee members can stay. I mean, I can stay for longer, but I know you guys have Ways and Means.
Ways and Means will convene at 4:30. And it will take three of us, four of us.
Yeah. Okay. So that is, we'll do our best, but... If you have a new perspective to add, great. But if you're going to say the same thing that everybody else has said already, say, I agree with that person, and here's why.
Very small.
And try to be succinct.
I'll do my best. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and committee members. My name is Carrie Nysine, and I'm the Vice President of Air Quality and Advocacy for the American Lung Association of Washington, and here to speak against the repeal of the Clean Fuel Standards.
The American Lung Association strongly supports the clean fuel standards because of the direct impact it will have on reducing air pollution in our state. Nearly 40% of our pollution comes from transportation sources, so if you have lungs, if you breathe in Oregon, then the Clean Fuels Program is a good program for you. When I think about the people especially benefit from the program, I think of our children who pound for pound breathe more air than adults do, and their developing lungs are more affected by air pollution. I wear a D around my neck on my necklace for my dad who has COPD, and I was lucky enough to spend Father's Day with him. And if you ever have time spending time with someone with COPD, you can hear the struggle as they take with every single breath. So this program is also good for the nearly 190,000 Oregonians with COPD, the 320,000 adults with asthma, and the 63,000 children with asthma. It also will strongly benefit the 700,000 Oregonians that live close to our roadways and busy roads in our Oregonians. People don't have a choice in the air that we breathe, but we do have a choice in what we put into our air. Again, we strongly support the program. We know from what's happened in California that there's great health benefits from the Clean Fuels Program. I know you care about our health, so I'm asking you to support Clean Fuels. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is David Brown. My company is Obsidian Renewables. I'm a developer here in Oregon of larger scale solar projects. My company has developed the three largest projects in Oregon, and just last week we announced that construction had begun on the solar project at Bly in Klamath County. That's a 5-megawatt project that will sell its power to Pacific Power starting in December. I submitted a page of testimony, which I will not read, but it's extremely compelling and very interesting, so I recommend it to you. I guess I want to say two things.
They're well written.
Yeah, and well written. You've read it, I see. So I want to say two things. I feel like I'm here testifying on behalf of two bills that are stuck together. So I hear a lot about a transportation bill, which I don't really know very much about, but it sounds to me like a lot of good work has been put into a bill that's not too big, not too small, and might need a little bit of tweaking, but I'm very, very excited to see that. Of course, as a member of the business community, I'm naturally very inclined towards transportation bills, and I'm very excited about that. In addition, we have the problem about the clean fuels situation, and I get that they're stuck together, but they're really very, very different. My own view on clean fuels is I support all forms of renewable energy. I wish that biofuels were more of a reality today than they are. I was very disappointed that the clean fuels bill, as it came towards the session, was a runaway train, and you couldn't even talk about possible amendments. You couldn't even have the conversation, and I was very concerned what the consequences might be of that strategy in getting it passed. However, I've read the bill completely. It's only 75 pages, but frankly, I think the pendulum swung a little bit too far the other way. I think there are some sensible things that can be done, and I think we should do those. I don't think the idea that we start with clean fuels is necessarily going to be productive, but I think that what you have before you can see some constructive adjustments. And one that I lay out is that, you know, carbon dioxide is carbon dioxide. Taking away from an important program that reduces emissions on behalf of electric generation to reduce emissions on behalf of transportation is a false trade, and I think it's an unnecessary trade. I think we can do both. I try to lay out that there is very cost-effective carbon reduction we can do with large-scale solar programs, and I think we can do cost-effective carbon reduction with transportation projects. And I know there's not much time. Of course, I'm happy to give as much of my time as I have to help you find that answer, but that's mostly what I wanted to say to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jamie?
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jamie Painter, and I'm here today on behalf of the Union of Concerned Scientists and our 11,000 supporters in Oregon. The Union of Concerned Scientists opposes House Bill 2281 and the B7 amendments. While we think that Oregon needs a strong transportation funding package to repair crumbling infrastructure and support transit options, we do not believe that we should have to choose between clean fuels and a transportation package. Our supporters recognize that fully implementing the Clean Fuels Program is an important step to cleaning the air, improving public health, and reducing the state's global warming emissions. What Clean Fuels market-based approach would create new industries and jobs from homegrown sources of fuel and diversify Oregon's fuel supplies, this bill would require Oregonians to pay for the package through new fees and taxes. We urge you to vote no on this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you each. Questions? Senator Johnson.
I apologize for jumping in and out. Would you mind stating your name?
Sorry.
No, not the woman next to you, please.
I'm Karen Easton with the American Lung Association.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you each.
Thanks.
Next up, Georgia Coolidge, David Williams, Chuck Bennett. On deck, Betsy Earls, Elizabeth Howe.
Mr. Chair. Respectfully, we also have a colleague in the audience. I don't know if he signed up to testify.
We talked. He's here to take the temperature of the room and glare at me.
Thank you. He does look familiar.
No, I asked him prior to the hearing.
Thank you. Yep. I apologize. I just...
Chair Edwards, for the record, my name is George O. Coolidge, here on behalf of DuPont Industries. We're here today in opposition of House Bill 2281 with the B7 amendment. You have a letter on Olus right now. It's titled Clean Fuels Work, that represents about 150 businesses that had endorsed the Oregon Clean Fuel Program and are opposed to see it repealed. We recognize and support a well-maintained transportation package as an essential part of doing business in Oregon, but the choice between investing and repairing in Oregon and whether or not Oregon implements the Clean Fuels Program, we see as sort of a false choice. Over the last 10 years, DuPont has invested hundreds of millions of dollars and challenged top scientists to deliver on the potential of cellulosic ethanol. This year, the DuPont cellulosic ethanol facility came online in Nevada, Iowa. This biorefinery will be fueled by corn stover biomasses harvested from a 30-mile radius around the facility. These corn stovers and biomass feedstocks do not displace crops for food. The Oregon Clean Fuels Program ensures a market access for biofuel producers, and in particular for cellulosic ethanol and advanced biofuels. Otherwise, without supportive biofuel policy, a large portion of the country's transportation fuel supply is really, we're sort of turning over to the oil companies' control of whether biofuels, which ones we can blend. State programs like the Oregon Clean Fuels Program are critical to the viability of the new cellulosic ethanol plants. In order for these new plants to survive, the carbon credit value is a critical component of the economic value of each gallon. In other words, without state fuel programs, cellulosic ethanol will not provide the return on investment needed for additional investments in future plants. Without specific provisions in the Oregon Clean Fuels Program for cellulosic ethanol, oil companies in Oregon will not purchase it, and sales will default to California. Commercialization of the cellulosic biofuels industry is creating jobs and does support farmers, and it drives innovation. The Oregon Clean Fuels Program has the potential to be a long-term, stable policy contributing to and creating competition in the transportation fuels market, and helps guide billions of dollars from around the world and here at home towards innovation in the United States and here at Oregon. Any legislative changes destabilizes that investment environment. We currently have a plant out in Hermiston that employs about 87 employees. It's a research facility. I know DuPont Industry is looking forward to doing additional investments in Oregon, but we see that this repeal of the Clean Fuels Program as being prohibitive of that. So we'd ask your support in opposing that House Bill 2281, the B7 amendment.
Let's assume that 324 continues to stand. Could you share with us DuPont's proposed investments in the state of Oregon?
I'd be happy to.
I'm listening.
Yeah. I mean, Chair Edwards, Senator Johnson, I don't have that on my fingertips right now, but I would be happy to follow up with them and get that information to you.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Is it safe to say that you built your plant in Iowa prior to the passage of 324?
The plant in Iowa was, Chair Edwards, Senator Johnson, was in the process of being developed. It started about 10 years ago when we invested.
So that's a yes?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Also for DuPont. Is it safe to assume then that the product that is being produced or will be produced in the Iowa plant is not cost competitive with gasoline or diesel in its current form?
Senator Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I believe that to be correct.
Thank you.
go ahead. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and we're not here on the broad issues of the bill that have so captivated so many of our colleagues that have been in front of you. We're focused right on Section 48, which deals with the public purchase, our public purpose expenditures. We have sent to you a copy of a report to the Legislative Assembly on public purpose expenditures January 2013 to June 2014. It was presented to the legislature in December. And hopefully you'll have an opportunity to look at that. We'd call your attention to pages associated with school districts, although it does give a really interesting description of the broader issues involved in this particular part of energy funding programs. What this says, Ms. Chair, quite simply, we had run into concerns among members of this committee and other members of the legislature that school districts were not using this program. And so we wanted to take a look at what the funding has actually accomplished in school districts. Currently, we use in excess of 100% of the funds that are allocated. We get about 10% of the public purpose dollars. Most recent numbers indicate that we have received $13 million and expended $15 million. We're actually oversubscribing in this area.
Expended how much?
15. In the energy conservation program, 825 schools are eligible for this program. 772, 94% of these eligible schools have completed the required energy audits. The participation is very substantial in this program, tremendous interest, as members of school districts have become aware that this is being discussed for elimination. Our email's starting to light up, and I'm sure you'll begin to hear from school districts as well that are very, very concerned about this. This is represented in thousands of measures over the 18-month study period, almost 6,000 measures, I think individual energy-saving activities by school districts. That have been taken using these funds. These have been really important. And then without any knowledge of what it means, I could go into how many therms and the rest of the stuff this has saved, but it's in the report. You all probably know this issue better than I do. What I think we want to get across to you, this is very important to public schools in this state. It is saving energy costs for us to be allowed to use these funds. This has been a highly successful program. And we would hate to lose this program under the misconception that it's not being used by school districts. It is a popular program that's being used.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams, representing Portland Public Schools. I just wanted to follow up with that with some sort of specifics around what districts are doing. I would note, obviously, this was created by the Senate Bill 1149 legislation in 1999, modified in subsequent sessions, and the year is dropping from my memory bank at the moment. The modification created the funds from this are paid directly from PGE and PacifiCorp directly to school districts, where previously they had been funneled through ESDs. So I think you're definitely seeing much higher utilization since those funds are directed straight to school districts. Districts are required to hold those funds in a segregated account, and then upon completion of projects, they reimburse themselves for the project costs that they did, and that has to be certified by the Department of Energy. Just to give you a sense, for Portland Public Schools, we receive about $830,000 annually from this program. Over its life, we've done over 450 energy projects with an implementation cost exceeding $8.5 million, and we estimate that our annual energy savings from this is about $1 million a year just from these projects. We currently have slated an additional about $830,000 in investments. A significant number of those are roof insulation work that we do to work on the building envelope to make it a much more airtight and energy efficient structure, as well as programmable thermostats and other digital control devices. Another district that I was able to get in touch with in the last 12 hours was the Beaverton School District. They are slated to do about $1.3 million worth of projects in the 15-16 school year as well. Similar work dealing with HVAC controls and insulation work, as well as commissioning, which, as Mr. Bennett said, we're getting outside our individual league here when we start talking about those things, but certainly work that all of these districts say is providing a great and valuable efficiency to their energy projects in the district.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I think you're about to make the point, though. Portland Public got $830,000 annually, but you've already done 450 projects at $8.5 million. So you're finding value in the energy savings from your energy bill doing projects. And so it's just the question of, absent the 830, are you going to abandon doing these projects that save as much money as they save for the operations of your buildings?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, no, obviously we want to be as efficient as we can with our capital construction projects. But as you know, school capital construction is a resource-constrained environment, even for districts that are able to pass capital bonds. We have done in the district passed a capital bond, and what these funds allow us to do is to leverage and do additional work above and beyond that. That while we may have been able to do this with existing funds, it means something else isn't getting done. Maybe it's rigging for a theater or some other work that we would do this instead.
How is
that
rigging for a you're saying it,
exactly
supplanting
it may
other money?
The priority would be placed on the energy efficiency when we would drop something else
the
off.
The other thing that I want to make sure people that are listening to this understand is that the only schools that are eligible for the ETO investment are those in the service area of PGE and PacifiCorp. So I don't want to leave the impression that all schools are affected equally.
Certainly, Senator Edwards, Senator Johnson, it is absolutely, it's a public purpose charge for those utilities. And again, as I said, the funds go directly from the utilities to the school districts.
Mr. Chair, one last question. Would it be fair to say that ETO should have copies of projects that were completed under this project, under this program, and that we ought to be able to get those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think that would be a question for the Energy Trust. I couldn't answer that.
Mr. Chair, I would respectfully ask that we get that from ETO. I think that would be very helpful.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest Senator Johnson, too, as you toss the net looking for this data, I'd also check with the PUC. They may well be the folks that are sitting on that information.
Thank you. Additionally, Senator Edwards, Senator Johnson, we obviously the only being aware of this in the last 24 hours or so. We were also sending out queries to business managers all across the state to try to get a better sense of where the vast majority of school districts are in their utilization of these funds as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you each. Next up, we're going to hear from Betsy Earls and Elizabeth Howe, and then after that, David Barenberg and Nellie DeVries. And then I've got a few more folks, but I just don't want to get too far ahead of time.
What's that? About 4:20, so we can have 10 minutes between us and those others.
Oh, okay.
If not, that's okay. I mean, I'll just leave, but okay. I'd like to hear everything.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing before you today as Mike Fries. I apologize, Mike had other commitments today, and we wanted to make sure and get AOI on the record to let you know how much we appreciate the work that has been done on this transportation package and amendments and the process that you've gone through. AOI is supportive of the broad outlines of the package that you have before you. The only other thing I wanted to tell you is that we're vetting the details with our members, but at this point, we feel pretty good about the package. And that is it.
All right.
Senator Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Howe, representing the Portland Business Alliance, wanting to largely say the same thing. Thank you for your work on moving toward a transportation package. Obviously, we need to invest in transportation to benefit our economy. Things will only get worse if we wait. Infrastructure deteriorates further. Interest rates are going to go up. If we move now, we can do so in a somewhat cost-effective way. PBA conducted a cost of congestion study showing that 350,000 Oregon jobs are transportation-related and transportation-dependent. Traffic delays are costing businesses money, which impacts competitiveness and forces changes in business operations and location decisions. But investments in transportation infrastructure will generate a return of $2.40 for every dollar spent, thousands of jobs, and billions in economic and non-economic benefits, including air emissions reductions. So we're supportive of the direction that you're taking, and just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
I'll ask you both similar question to what I asked OBA, being that you're both business groups. I don't remember where PBA was. I know AOI was opposed to the clean fuels bill. And so while you weren't excited about that, has your support for a transportation package been contingent upon repeal of clean fuels?
Mr. Chair, for the record again, Betsy Earls, I did hear you ask that question of OBA earlier and checked with Mike Fries. Evidently, the answer is that our support for the transportation package you have before you is contingent on the pieces about low-carbon fuels that you have before you, not necessarily repeal of the whole thing.
And, Mr. Chair, Elizabeth, for PBA, do not believe PBA took a position on the low-carbon fuel standard.
Don't remember.
But I also do not believe that support for a transportation package would be contingent on the clean fuels pieces of the package.
Questions for the panel? Okay. Thank you both. Did I say it was up next? Did I say? David Barenberg and Nellie DeVries. David. Is Nellie here? Not here.
I don't know.
If she comes here soon. How about Craig Honeyman? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave Barenberg, representing the City of West Lynn. Thank you for the opportunity to briefly testify. I know it's been a long hearing, and I just wanted to briefly mention the long delays in traffic on 205, where it's two lanes, and wanted to, as the chair said, say that I will agree with Chair Ludlow and Commissioner Savas from Clackamas County that that is an issue that we would respectfully request additional funds to move forward with the EIS, which we have heard is about $10 million. And we understand that on a project like this, momentum builds momentum. And it is the one place where there are two lanes. There are over 100 accidents, most being rear-enders. In that segment of the roads, it has 80 to 100,000 vehicles transversing it daily. And for the city of West Lynn, one of the streets in the city is fondly known as the third lane of 205 because people cut through the city and it jams up local transportation. We've had the inability to develop some property in the city for commercial purposes because of potential backups into intersections that are inadequate to serve traffic on 205 and people using our cut-throughs. With that, I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify and for the work of the members and the work of the Gang of Eight. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director for the League of Oregon Cities, representing all 242 cities in the state. I'm pleased to be able to have the opportunity here to offer you some city perspectives on this measure, and to I'm even more pleased to tell you that the League supports the Dash B7 amendments to this legislation. Passage, you may recall back in the early days of the session when my staff and I went around to meet with all of you, transportation was one of our top priorities, and I'm glad that even at this late hour we're finally having a meaningful discussion about a transportation package. Like others before me, I want to thank everybody, those of you on this committee and others not on this committee, who have worked so hard to bring the legislation to this point. I know it's been a difficult and very time-consuming process, and your hard work is sincerely appreciated. Let me just very quickly highlight those portions of the Dash B7 amendments that address the League's transportation priorities. And first and foremost is the overriding principle that we need to fix it first. We need to protect, we maintain and preserve the investment we already have on the ground. And I believe the Dash 7s largely do that. Specifically, the gas tax and fee increases, the city's 20% share of that, the $41.2 million, which has been alluded to before annually, will be very helpful in providing additional resources for city street maintenance budgets that are already short by about $300 million in the aggregate a year. I'm referencing a 2014 LOC local street needs report. I can assure you that that money will be well spent. Driver's license fee aspect of this bill we're supportive of as well, as we do believe the DMV IT system needs an upgrade, and the funding for that is important. The electric and hybrid vehicle registration fee ensures that newer technology vehicles pay their fair share as well. Let me close by saying, even with passage of this bill, and hopefully that occurs, there's work to be done. The League hopes that discussions will ensue in future sessions regarding indexing the gas tax to make this source of funding truly sustainable as long as it continues to be the primary source of highway funding. In addition, increased funding for a jurisdictional transfer of orphan highways also needs to be addressed down the road. But for now, this is a job well done, especially given all the circumstances surrounding this issue. I urge your approval of this package. Thank you.
Thank you both. Questions for panelists? Thank you. Next, Jim McCauley and Gwen Baldwin. And after that will be Marcia Kelly, Paul Edgar, and Roger Kay.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Gwen Baldwin, and I'm here today representing the city of Beaverton. As a growing suburb, a suburban city, Beaverton is deeply, deeply aware of the significant transportation maintenance and repairs needed in our overall transportation system. And we have a strong, on-the-record commitment to sustainable operations, including tangible carbon reduction and the Clean Fuels Program. We do not see these as a trade or an either or. Both are needed. And we have an opportunity in this package to make that happen. The B7 before you today is the result of intensive work. I extend appreciations to everybody who is a part of the Gang of Eight and what each of you have signed up for in terms of intense work to come. And the result is really critical to all of our needs and all of our benefits. The final bill that you produce will be the result of not only the Gang of Eight work, the work that you do here, work down the hall, work upstairs. It's a work in progress, but you are beginning that in earnest and in public today, and that has to start. And we appreciate and applaud you doing so, and we look forward to working with you toward the end result. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the record, Chair Edwards, committee member Jim McCauley representing Washington County. I think in the interest of time, the easiest thing to say is everything that Craig Honeyman had to say was spot on. From our perspective, transportation investments in this state and in our county has been a longstanding priority and continues to be a priority even in this stage of where we're at with the session. I had a chance to certainly pull all of our commissioners here this morning actually into a person. Everybody supports this package as it is written today. I think there is some question over project selection, I will say, and having had a chance to listen to Matt Garrett as well as some of the other conversation going on earlier in terms of how those projects are physically selected, I think our folks will have a better sense of how priorities and things of that nature were selected. I mean, as a county, we of course have our own priorities where we think investments need to be and things of that nature as well, but I think on balance, when we look at this package, it is important for you to go ahead and move forward. One thing that's, I think, we were silent throughout the whole clean fuels process, but I'll tell you from a perspective in terms of how the county handles policy and regulation is for every opportunity that they come across, I think they look for a non-regulatory approach as opposed to a regulatory vision, looking at trying to achieve objectives and things of that nature. And I think that's part of what fits within this overall framework is you have essentially a way to get to the same type of reductions using different methods and maybe a different structure. And I'm certainly no expert. I'm no chemist. I don't know where the modeling on this thing phases out. But at least when we look at a comparison and things of that nature, I think that's where some of the folks within our organization are going to fall. So thank you very much.
Well, the devil's in the details with a non-regulatory approach is why we have a problem with global climate change right now. So, you know, whether or not we do this program or that program, something needs to happen in terms of carbon reduction. So they're substantial. So.
Mr. McCauley, I'm not questioning your word, but I'm puzzled because you said that all your commissioners support the package as it's currently written?
Chair Edwards, Senator Hayward, that is correct, based on conversations with them this morning.
Okay. Thanks.
Did they know it was in the package? No, I mean, seriously.
No. Yes, no.
Like, I mean, that's a, I mean, I think it's a legitimate question for a bill that came out in printed, an amendment that came out in printed form last night, and I've learned a ton about during this hearing. So, I mean, there's no way that somebody could know everything that was, you know, I mean, unless you were involved in crafting it and negotiating it, it's, you know.
Chair, it's fair enough. They didn't, they haven't had the perspective, obviously, of listening to the additional details brought out today, but they had the materials last night, walked them through verbally. These were not a, you know, 30-second conversations. These are probably 20 to 30 minutes each with each individual as I was walking them through this process. But again, going forward, this is the type of framework that they would support. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Marcia Kelly, Paul Edgar, and Roger Kay.
Mr. Chair.
And I believe that's everybody that has signed up. So if there is anybody else that would like to testify that has not signed up, you will be up next.
I'm getting toxic samples. Yeah. I'm in a boogie.
Okay.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Marsha Kelly. I'm speaking for the Oregon Revenue Coalition first, and I will add some comments for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. The Oregon Revenue Coalition meets regularly in the building to discuss equitable and fair taxation and revenue to fund programs in the state of Oregon. We were able to get an outline of what was in the bill yesterday prior to our regular Tuesday meeting, and we have concerns about some of the things that are in the package. The appropriation of the public's purpose trust is one thing of concern. An equitable distribution of costs for doing things that seems to have tilted from partial business in some of the environmental choices to mainly the taxpayers and users in the state of Oregon. And taxing of employees for transit was a concern of many of those people. That's the Revenue Coalition. As the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, I am also concerned about the transit portion of the bill, because as six of you sat up there, only two of you would be in transit districts that would be able to utilize these funds. Transit and transportation districts all around the state have various ways of getting funding. Some of them almost entirely depend upon money that comes from the state through portions of the gas tax from lawn mower use, portions of the cigarette tax, funding from maybe a local municipal entity, and some of us are on property tax. So by only including a transit portion for those people who are on the payroll tax, you have eliminated many, many transportation districts and a mass transit district, although we are not a mass transit district formed under in Salem, that is not formed under the same mass transit formula as Portland and Eugene. So we do not have an option of using a payroll tax in Salem without going to the voters for approval. But the fact that transit is included in the package is great. Working women around the state need public transportation, and not just in the metropolitan Portland area. And so if this goes forward as it is, I do hope that in future times the legislature does not consider that they have funded transit by this one funding fix, because it hasn't done anything for Basin Transit or U-Trans or Sunset Transit or the many, many other little entities that really are some of the lifelines for seniors and other people depending upon public transportation in the state. Women earn less money, have less ability to spend money on transportation for cars and gasoline, and I think that that's an important thing to look at when you're looking at the equitableness of this particular transportation package.
Senator Johnson.
I guess I'd have to put the question to you, what would you have us do in Salem? What would work in Salem when the Salem voters have rejected support at the ballot box? And I guess the corollary to that is, would you be willing to let the perfect get in the way of the good? I can assure you that we discuss transit at length, but tell me what you would have the legislature do to the voters of Salem when they have rejected the notion at the polls.
They've rejected the notion at the polls. The latest time was in 2008. We were planning on going to the ballot in November for approval to implement, in addition to the property tax, which is, of course, you know, a decreasing thing, a payroll tax, which would then allow us or force us then to tax the employees as well as the employers. If I'm reading it correctly, and because the language was just there. A dedicated fund statewide that could be apportioned on a regional basis would be something that would be as valuable to many, many Oregonians as some of the other transportation options were given.
Yeah. I might be a ballerina if circumstances were different. They're not. And so what I'm trying to figure out is, does the perfect get in the way of the good here? $80 million of dedicated transit money, albeit for a limited number of transit districts. Are you willing to reject that because there isn't a statewide plan to fund all the little districts?
I did not say that I was rejecting it. What I did say was that I hoped that this did not end the conversation on funding transit, because there are women across the state who need better public transportation than what we are offering now.
It's not just
and that's
women.
A matter of getting to work.
Yeah, it's not just women. I would submit to you that lots of folks need
it. I know, but I'm speaking for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. We heard testimony earlier this afternoon from both TriMet and Elaine Transit District that this would actually be good for people who are low income.
I agree. Okay. I'm not in opposition of funding via payroll taxes. What I do think is when the only option you have is dependent upon a particular funding that very few districts in the state have, you then limit what the funding availability to transit.
I'm from one of those districts.
I'm
actually virtually
I understand.
All the area
I know
that
basins.
I represent, and you know, we can't do everything in one bill. So I agree with you that it would be nice to be able to move forward with some other things. But this is really not what this bill does.
Senator Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I just wanted to bring forth the fact that this portion, as a funding for transit, is not a be-all and end-all for all transit districts, and that I hope the conversation did not stop there.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify that is not signed up to testify? All right. Seeing nobody else, we are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2281B, and stay tuned, and we are adjourned. Thank you.